spy. Secrets, lies, covert operations.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
It's about the CIA, but not as you know it.
Do you want to work in intelligence or espionage?
What's the difference? Central Intelligence starts tomorrow at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning. This is Today with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett.
Yes, it's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 12th of September. Good to be with you. The headlines today. A new report for the government warns that the NHS in England is in a critical condition and the problems could take up to 8 years to fix. We'll be speaking to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting. And a US billionaire is hoping to attempt the first ever privately funded spacewalk this morning. That is due to happen at around 20 past seven, so we hope to bring you that news live.
Also in today's programme...
A few minutes ago, there was a massive explosion from the back of the MC at about 7:24. A pall of smoke rose from the roof. There were shots fired, and about 30 seconds, 45 seconds later, a second explosion.
That was Kate Adie reporting on the 1980 siege of the Iranian embassy in London. And now best-selling author Ben McIntyre has written about it. He'll join us alongside one of those who was held hostage. Following her win at last night's National Television Awards, we'll speak to the screenwriter behind Mr. Bates versus The Post Office and Oscar-winning actress Kate Winslet on her portrayal of Lee Miller, the model for Vogue, who became a pioneering war correspondent.
She lived a whole life way beyond that time, and she hated being a model. She always said, "I'd rather take a picture than be one."
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
A new report warns that the National Health Service in England is in a critical condition. The surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi, who's now an independent peer, conducted a rapid review for the government. He said the problems could take up to 8 years to fix. Sir Keir Starmer will say in a speech today that the NHS must reform or die. More details from our health editor Hugh Pym.
Lord Darzi said the NHS in England was in a critical condition, but the vital signs were strong. He said public confidence had been damaged by repeatedly missed waiting times targets. People were struggling to get GP appointments and A&E was in an awful state. The report said spending on buildings and equipment before the pandemic was inadequate and there was a £37 billion shortfall compared with other leading international health systems. Sir Keir Starmer will today set out the government's response. He'll say that a 10-year plan will be drawn up with fundamental reform and the biggest reimagining of the NHS since its birth.
The United Nations Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has described as unacceptable an Israeli airstrike on a school building in Gaza in which six staff from the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees died. The school in Nusayrat, which has faced repeated missile attacks since last October, houses displaced Palestinians. Antonio Guterres wrote on social media that what he called dramatic violations of international humanitarian law must stop. The Israeli military said it was targeting a Hamas command centre in the grounds. An American billionaire is hoping to attempt the first ever privately funded walk in space in just over an hour's time. The Polaris craft left Earth on Tuesday with Jared Isaacman, the commander of a four-strong crew. Our science reporter Georgina Reynard has been following the mission.
Three, two, one.
It sounded like a standard space launch, but this mission hopes to make history. The billionaire Jared Isaacman, who funded this Polaris project, aims to complete a spacewalk with the engineer Sarah Gillis. The crew will wear a new type of spacesuit that can be worn inside and out of the machine, so there'll be no need for an airlock on the craft. All space travel is risky, but this is particularly dangerous with the first test of the equipment in space.
Data centres in the UK are to join the emergency services, financial systems and energy and water supplies as critical national infrastructure. The change means they'd receive extra support during a major incident, such as a cyber attack, an IT outage or an emergency caused by extreme weather. The government described the centres as the engines of modern life, and US tech giants, including Amazon, Microsoft and Google, are investing heavily in new UK-based sites. Pharmacies, pubs and banks made up half of the closures on Britain's high streets in the first 6 months of this year, according to new data. The research from the accountancy firm PwC says dozens of coffee shops and convenience stores have opened, but not enough to fill the space. Here's our business correspondent, Emma Simpson.
For the last decade, this research has been tracking the openings and closures in our high streets, retail parks and shopping centres. It focuses on chains, everything from retail and cafes to gyms and hairdressers. On average, 18 chemists, 16 pubs and 9 banks closed every week between January and June. Banks have been in steady decline as banking has moved online. Pharmacies and pubs have been impacted by restructuring. Trouble is, the overall picture in today's research is that yet again there aren't enough new openings to make up for all the closures, resulting in a net decline of 12 outlets a day across Great Britain.
The ITV drama that renewed interest in the Post Office Horizon IT scandal was the biggest winner at last night's National Television Awards. Mr Bates vs the Post Office was named Best New Drama, and Toby Jones won Best Drama Performance for his portrayal of the former sub-postmaster Sir Alan Bates. The series had already received the NTA's Impact Award. On stage at the ceremony in London, Joe Hamilton, who was wrongly convicted of fraud, said many of those affected were still waiting for compensation.
I went to Westminster a couple of weeks back and saw the new minister, and trust me, nothing has changed. And out of the group of 555, more than 300 haven't been paid yet, including Sir Alan Bates. They've offered him 30% of his claim.
The government said it was working tirelessly to provide compensation and that almost £300 million had been paid out so far. Peru's former president, Alberto Fujimori, has died at the age of 86, 10 months after he was granted a pardon and freed from jail. He was forced from office in 2000 after 10 years in power and was later convicted of human rights abuses and sentenced to 25 years. But he was credited by many Peruvians with bringing economic stability and defeating a long-running left-wing insurgency.
Thanks very much. It is 6 minutes past six. Let's get the latest on the weather and go over to Stav Danaos at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Stav.
Good morning to you, Emma and Amol. Thank you very much. Well, the weather's in a chilly phase right now, with cold northwesterly winds bringing air down from Iceland. Winds today won't be quite as strong as yesterday, and we should see fewer showers, but there'll still be some heavy ones around with some hail and thunder mixed in as well. High pressure, though, starts to build in from the southwest tomorrow. That will cut off the northerly airflow, so slowly temperatures will begin to recover to get closer back to normal as we head in towards the weekend. Today, though, for England and Wales, it's a cold start, a touch of frost in places, but mostly dry with plenty of sunshine, and not so for northwest England and also northern and western Wales. Here we're starting with plenty of showers running through the Cheshire Gap and affecting parts of northern and western Wales and Anglesey too. Now, these showers will become more widespread as temperatures increase. So by the afternoon, they'll turn up pretty much anywhere, and some will be heavy with hail and thunder. Northerly winds will be chilly, lighter than yesterday, and temperatures mid to high teens. Scotland and Northern Ireland, plenty of showers to start for Northern Ireland, northwest Scotland. Elsewhere, it's cold and clear with some sunshine. Showers again also becoming more widespread, but some parts of eastern Scotland will escape them and stay dry. And it will be chilly, temperatures in the low teens, so we'll blow par across all areas for this time of year. Tonight, showers will linger across some coastal areas, otherwise it's a cold and dry night with clear skies and a touch of frost. Tomorrow, though, it does look like we'll start to see a chilly start, plenty of sunshine, but it will start to be a little bit warmer in places than previous days, with rain and wind arriving across Scotland and Northern Ireland later on.
Stav, thank you very much indeed for that. It is 8 minutes past six. Let's take you through some of the main stories in the papers, what's happening on news websites. So the front pages this morning are dominated by coverage of Lord Darzi's report on the state of the NHS. The Daily Telegraph focuses on the low productivity identified in the health service, with the headline, NHS does less despite record funding. Thousands dying due to NHS delays is the splash in The Guardian. It says the report is a damning critique of how neglect of the health service by previous governments has left it unable to offer patients timely care.
Labour orders biggest NHS reform in history is the headline in The Times. The paper says Lord Darzi's findings will be used for three clear purposes. Firstly, by Labour ministers to pin blame on the Conservatives. Secondly, by health officials to argue for billions more in funding. And finally, as a lever to force the NHS to change.
The Daily Mail looks ahead to what Sir Keir Starmer could announce in his speech on this subject later today. The paper says new measures are expected to involve shifting billions of pounds from what it calls inefficient hospitals to community care and a focus on preventing people getting unwell in the first place. The Eye says that weight loss drugs such as Ozempic are likely to play a key role in the shake-up.
The Daily Mirror has the headline, "A decade to fix our broken NHS," while the Daily Express demands no more sticking plasters.
We'll be speaking to Hugh Pym, our health editor, about this just after 6:30, and Wes Streeting, the social and health care secretary, at 8:10. The Daily Mirror, turning to other subjects, the US presidential election debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump also looms large this morning. The Guardian leads with Trump in damage control mode. The Financial Times says Mr. Trump's campaign is reeling in the wake of what it calls his poor performance. The paper says the former president's allies were left exasperated and thought he had been unprepared, outplayed, and had delivered erratic messages to voters. The Daily Telegraph says there are reports of Republican donors reconsidering their campaign contributions. The Daily Star says Mr. Trump has gone bonkers after he claimed illegal immigrants were eating America's pets. And the New York Times says Mrs. Harris took advantage of her opponent's biggest weakness, Donald Trump's ego.
In other news, the Times says the UK and the US are on the verge of allowing Ukraine to use British and American long-range missiles against targets inside Russia. The Foreign Secretary David Lammy and his American counterpart Antony Blinken have been discussing the issue with President Zelensky in Kyiv. The paper says they'll now take a look at what they learned back to their respective leaders, something we'll come on to shortly.
And the Sun goes big on the results of last night's National Television Awards with the headline, "Strictly Still, Cha-Cha Champs." How do you do it? Is that a Cha-Cha Champs? Cha-Cha. Cha-Cha Champs.
That's it.
Cha-Cha Champs.
Give it a move.
Cha-Cha Champs. The paper says, Cha-Cha Champs. The paper says BBC One's Strictly Come Dancing shook off a summer of scandal to win its 9th consecutive victory in the talent show category. The Sun says it shows the public still backs the programme despite months of allegations of inappropriate behaviour behind the scenes.
But please don't do that again. You did it quite a few times.
I thought I nailed it by the third time. No.
Yeah, it's good that we were all there for the rehearsal just live on Radio 4. It is 11 minutes past six. I said we'd return to that story about Ukraine and what may be a change, because yesterday, in the first joint overseas visit in more than a decade, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken travelled with the Foreign Secretary David Lammy to Ukraine as a show of support. James Landell, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, was travelling with them. Actually, when I spoke to you, James, yesterday, you were on a train, I believe. But that key issue on the table with President Zelensky was permitting the use of long-range Western weapons for strikes inside Russia. James, what has the Foreign Secretary told you about where the balance of debate lies on this issue? Good morning.
Good morning. I think what we've heard on this trip are two clear arguments in favour of relaxing those rules for Ukraine and its use of long-range missiles. The first is this question of Iran. What Mr. Lammy told me is that the fact that Western intelligence agencies now are confident that Russia has access to tens, if not hundreds, of Iranian missiles, in Mr. Lammy's words, changes the debate. Because what it does, it gives Russia a greater capability to use its longer range missiles to strike deeper into Ukraine. And that is something that could change the balance on the battlefield. That's the first point. The second point, made by both Mr. Lammy and by Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, is they said it is Russia that is now the one that's doing the escalating, both in terms of what's happening in the East, but also in terms of the way it is using missiles to strike and the targets it's striking here in Ukraine. And so what we heard are those two arguments, which are in favour of saying, look, Ukraine, there's a reason why we need to give Ukraine this greater freedom to use long-range missiles to strike Russian targets. But what we didn't hear yesterday is anything definitive. And I think diplomats are steering away from the idea that there'll be an announcement in Washington tomorrow when the Prime Minister meets the President. And I think the thinking now is that a decision, if it's going to be made, might come later this month when President Zelensky meets President Biden in New York in the margins of the UN General Assembly.
James Landell, our diplomatic correspondent. Thank you.
Well, in about an hour and 10 minutes, two people are preparing to become, or will become perhaps, the first private citizens to exit a spacecraft and walk in space. They're in the privately funded Polaris craft, which left Earth on Tuesday, and we're hoping we're going to bring it to you live. Georgina Ranard is our climate and science reporter. Morning, Georgina. What are we expecting to see?
Good morning. Well, as you said, this is expected to start within the hour. They're up there right now preparing. So the crew of four have been doing pre-breathing for probably 2 days. That means replacing nitrogen in their blood with oxygen to stop decompression sickness, or what we would call the bend. They will then start to depressurize this craft. They want to match the space vacuum outside. At this point, they'll probably be wearing their spacesuits. These are new spacesuits that have been designed to wear inside and outside. They're made by SpaceX and they're an upgrade on their previous ones. All four crew will probably be wearing them. The door will open and there's no airlock inside this craft, which is an incredibly daring and probably quite risky move. And then just two of the crew will go out, and that will be Jared Isaacman, the billionaire who funded this mission, and followed by SpaceX engineer Sarah Gillis. It is a risky operation. Only Jared Isaacman has been to space before of the four crew, and the suits are untested. But these are the risks that SpaceX and Isaacman appear to be willing to make. And that's what this is about. How far will the private sector go in space travel and exploration compared to the public sector? Because, of course, only government-funded space agencies like NASA have done these type of spacewalks before. So we'll be eagerly watching. The stream is live and we're going to see what happens in the next hour or two.
It's going to be exciting. I think, Emma, you're going to be describing it live, which is going to be an incredible...
I am. My narration of space travel is renowned. So
practicing, exactly.
It's as good as your cha-cha.
Yeah, exactly. Georgina Ratnard, our climate and science reporter. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, gosh, here we go. A quarter past six. It's not really nerve-wracking for us, but making sure we bring you the news as it happens and what we can see is. But following the news, the government will provide a £500 million grant to Tata Steel in Port Talbot. There remains concerns this morning about what it means for both the plant and the wider community. And Will Bain has more on that and, of course, the rest of the business news. Good morning to you, Will.
Morning, Emma. Morning, Amal. Yeah, looking forward to the cha-charing in space between the two of you. But, yeah, in the business news this morning, that money and where it will go, what it will go towards, apparently towards building greener electric arc furnace in Port Talbot, and matches the amount previously agreed by the Conservative government as well. However, more than 2,500 jobs remain at risk at the plant in South Wales. And in a moment, we'll hear from one of the unions representing those staff. But first, Desney Hill is the finance boss of Bartlett Engineering, which has supplied Tata in Port Talbot for decades. She remains worried about the future.
We do rather large parts for Tata, mainly for Tata. I'd say 90% of our work comes from Tata. We've been a tier one supplier, as we were originally called, since it was British Steel. And we've seen it transform from British Steel to Corus to Tata. We've always worked together with them, really. We've got to trim the cloth to suit the weave, really, haven't we? We're still okay at the moment. But, I mean, it means such a lot to so many people. Because they can say they're making 2,500 redundant. It's far more than that. It's even down to window cleaners. Who's going to employ window cleaners when they're at home all day and they can clean their own windows? It's just such a big domino effect. You can't blithely say, oh, this 15 people working in the office is going to be unemployed. It's not. It's the 15 people that they each employ, and it just snowballs. It's terrible. It's a terrible thing.
Desney Hill there, the finance director at Bartlett Engineering, one of the suppliers of Tata in Port Talbot. Well, Unite is the union that represents more than 1,500 staff at Tata Port Talbot, and its national lead officer is Oné Kassab. Oné, morning.
Good morning.
£500 million then, enough?
Well, this is just the first stage. The company and the government have committed to further talks to evaluate future investment opportunities. And we need to see that detail. So yesterday's news is welcome, but we need to see the detail about what future investment opportunities look like. So that there's more work to be done. Welcome, as yesterday's news is.
You can hear from the community there that they're yet to be convinced that they aren't going to be back in the same position again. As they have been many times over the years, facing more questions.
Yes, and that's why we've been fighting so hard as a trade union, including industrial action ballots. That's why we have taken the stance that we have done. We've worked with local communities and business as well as part of the campaign to save jobs. So yesterday's announcement is welcome, but we need something more substantial, something more permanent. And that's why when the government talks about a plan, we need to see the detail of that as quickly as possible.
In terms of the job losses that were potentially on the table in the sort of medium long term, does it mean anything to that 2,500 number with the sort of 300 to come this money yesterday, or are those jobs gone?
Well, those people who have volunteered for redundancy, that process will go through, but the majority of Unite's 1,500 members will remain at the plant. And I'm pleased to say that through our work, we have avoided today any compulsory redundancies of Unite members. But those who have volunteered for redundancy, then that process will go through.
Plenty of sentiment from the Conservative Party and others, and you actually kind of heard a sense of it there from Desney Hill as well, didn't you, that this is actually a false dawn, providing false hope to people.
That's why we will be holding both Tata and the government's feet to the fire. So, you know, we've still got a job to do to make sure that the promises that were made yesterday are actually kept to. The big point here is that this could have been done a long time ago, and this could have been done under the previous government, and we could have been further on down the line. So while it's good that it's been done now, and I said we welcome it, people are right to be concerned and angry, because this should have been done a long, long time ago.
Well, the Business and Trade Secretary Jonathan Reynolds telling the BBC yesterday that the government will be laying out a steel strategy in the spring, and said also that this was a hope for the future of steelmaking in South Wales, this particular announcement. Oné Kassab from the Unite Union, thanks so much for your time. Rachel Winter, Partner and Investment Manager at Killick & Co, is with us to pick through everything that's moving financial markets this morning. Rachel, morning.
Morning, Will.
And the big one was the US inflation data yesterday, which was a bit of positive news for the markets.
It was, yes, very good news here. So the inflation rate in the US has come down from 2.9% to 2.5%, so quite a significant reduction. And this really paves the way for the Federal Reserve to start cutting interest rates. So we are now hoping for a cut to happen when the Federal Reserve meets next week. That will be good news for the markets. And I think in anticipation of that, the market rose yesterday when this inflation data was published.
And the first of a few cuts, do you think?
Hopefully, yes. We are hoping for a number of cuts this year and next.
Let's stick in the US. More trouble for Boeing, the plane manufacturer. The new chief exec, pretty new, Kelly Ortberg, pretty much pleading with his workers, right, not to go on strike. This is all over a pay deal.
Yes, so the union has been offered a 25% pay rise over the next 4 years, and the union is saying this is the best deal it's ever negotiated, but there still appears to be a risk that the deal will be rejected by the workers of Boeing. Been a very difficult few years for Boeing. The shares are down 60% over the past 5 years, so they will really be hoping for some good news.
Yeah, so when Kelly Ortberg, the boss there, talks about putting the recovery in jeopardy, that's the backdrop of the kind of economic situation that they're in, different, I guess, to previous industrial action or threats of industrial action that they may have faced just because of that, you know, that move in the share price that you talked about.
Yeah, so the company really does need to start recovering. For that, they do need to save some costs, but they also need their best people. So they need to do their best to retain the good workers that they do have.
And a quick look closer to home, Rachel. Rightmove, the property portal, rejecting a takeover approach from Australian rival Rupert Murdoch-backed company REA Group.
Yeah, so this bid was seen as quite opportunistic. Rightmove has a market share of about 80% of the UK's online property listings. It does well when there's a lot of activity going through the property market. Over the last couple of years, because interest rates have been high, there has been less activity. That's resulted in a drop in the share price of Rightmove. And that, we think, is the reason why this bid has come in at the current time. So it was rejected. We'll have to wait and see if the company comes back with a better offer.
And how much of it, I suppose, is not to do with necessarily what Rightmove's offering, but about the price that the REA Group might get for Rightmove. We're still seeing that UK companies, UK-listed companies, often pretty cheap for foreign competitors to try and snap up.
Yes, exactly. So we have seen a lot of acquisitions of UK companies over the past couple of years. However, we have seen a strengthening of the pound in recent months. That will make these UK companies seem a little bit more expensive to overseas buyers. So we might see reduction in the number of bids coming in.
Rachel, thanks so much for your time this morning. Rachel Winter there, partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. Now, a lot of discussion around the government's tricky near-term fiscal situation in the run-up to next month's budget. The Chancellor is committed to announce a tax roadmap for business, as she puts it. But how clear is the path ahead for the public finances? We're going to get a bit of a snapshot this morning. And Dan Hansen, Chief UK Economist of Bloomberg Economics, is with us. Dan, morning.
Morning.
And that snapshot's going to come from the Office for Budget Responsibility. What are we likely to learn?
So we'll get this report from the OBR today, and it's something that they do every year, and it's a long-term look at the public finances, so over the course of 50 years. And these reports tend to be pretty sobering, to be honest with you, because they tend to include some pretty big numbers. So last year when the OBR put this report together, it told us that the public sector net debt, so the debt burden in the UK, was going to rise pretty sharply over the next 50 years. So debt as a share of GDP at the moment is about 100% of GDP. The OBR said over the next 50 years it might rise to as much as 300% of GDP, which is just an enormous number. And the thing that drives this and that sort of underpins what the OBR is assuming is what happens with demographics in the UK. So it's underpinned by what's going on with an ageing population. That means over time fewer people are paying taxes, there's more expenditure on pensions and welfare, and that's what pushes up the debt burden. So I think, as I say, these reports, that they're very sobering, but the thing I think it's a long-term look at the public finances. It's different to what we get at the budget, which is a shorter-term look. And it's just there to highlight the risks and the longer-term trends in the public finances.
I guess politically, and I'm sure most of our listeners, Dan, will have heard more about the OBR in the past 3 or 4 years than perhaps that they would have done in the decades before. And that's often because of the fiscal rules that both the previous government and the current government have talked about. How will this, or how will what we find out today, shape the framework around that?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. So I think what we're seeing at the moment with the OBR, and you're right, it has been in the public domain probably more than it wanted to be as well over the past few years. I think what we'll see today is, as I say, this is a long-term look, but the fiscal rules are something that the Chancellor is certainly looking at. We know the public finances are stretched, and it's quite possible when we get to the budget, so not today, but when we get to the budget on October the 30th, she does have a rethink of what we do with the fiscal rules. At the moment, the rule is to get debt as a share of GDP falling in the fifth year of the forecast horizon, so in 5 years' time. She said that she will stick to that rule, but there are things she could tweak around it to give her a little more fiscal space. And of course, if she creates more fiscal space, so more room to borrow, it means that the questions around tax will become a little bit easier.
Like what? What could be tweaked?
So the one thing we can do in the public finances is that you can change the definition of debt. So at the moment, the debt measure that the previous government used was it's called public sector net debt, excluding the Bank of England. If you include the Bank of England, the OBR's March forecast showed that there would be an extra £16 billion of headroom that she could use, so extra £16 billion to borrow more. And as I say, that obviously makes the questions around tax rises and spending cuts a little bit easier.
Well, we'll find perhaps some of those answers to those questions. 9:30, I think that report's out. Dan Hansen, Chief UK Economist of Bloomberg Economics, thanks so much for your time.
Will, thank you very much indeed. More from you after 7 o'clock. But for now, at 27 minutes past 6, we say good morning to Simon, who's got the sport. Hi, Simon.
Good morning to you. A fresh-faced England's men's cricket side fell to a 28-run defeat to Australia in the opening T20 of their series in Southampton. The tourists were bowled out for 179 in the first innings, with Travis Head top-scoring with a 23-ball 59. The Australian left-hander took particular glee in plundering England all-rounder Sam Curran's first over, every ball a boundary.
Curran over mid-wicket for four. Goes more of a length this time. Cream through the covers for four. Oh, he's gone big this time. Swung over deep mid-wicket for six. Oh, he's gone big again. He's gone high. So he's gone for six more. He's got down on one bent knee. Now has he hit this for six as well? He has. Curran in again. Left arm angle and Head likes it once more. And it'll be four this time. 4-4. 6-6. 6-4. Off one. Sam Curran over.
Now, that over might have sounded decent. Worth watching on the BBC Sport website if you've got a couple of minutes. After that blistering spell, England did steady things somewhat by deploying some leg spin, with Liam Livingstone taking 3 for 23 in two overs. But the hosts never got hold of their chase and were all out for 151. The second match of the series is on Friday. Ireland's women overcame a batting collapse to earn a memorable consolation 3-wicket win in the rain-affected third and final one-day international against England. That was their first win over England in that format since 2001. It was a truly tense finish, with 8 needed from the final over. Ireland lost 3 wickets in 3 balls to leave nerves jangling, with 4 runs required from the last ball, which Alana Dalzell struck for the winning boundary. And Essex have been docked 12 points by the Cricket Discipline Commission after one of their players used an oversized bat this season, all but ending their hopes of winning the county championship. Tennis, and debutant Billy Harris and veteran Dan Evans ensured Great Britain's quest to reach the Davis Cup knockout stage started strongly, even without the rested British number one Jack Draper. Harris and Evans won their singles matches to guarantee a team victory in the best of three Group D tie against Finland. But the Brits were unable to get the 3-0 whitewash as they lost the doubles, which may yet come back to bite them. The next tie is against Argentina in Group D tomorrow. And finally, Cristiano Ronaldo has criticised Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag and said the club must rebuild everything in order to compete for football's biggest prizes again. The Dutchman is under pressure after United's 8th-placed finish last season. That's their lowest in Premier League history, and 2 defeats in their opening 3 games at the start of this season.
There you go, Simon. Thank you very much. Radio 4 is celebrating some brilliant writing this evening.
These stories demonstrate the best of short fiction around at the moment.
The BBC National Short Story Award 2024, judged by panellists including Michael Doncourt and Di Spears.
The power of the short story remains really exciting for me.
The finalists will be announced in Front Row tonight at 7:15. Then hear them for yourself every weekday afternoon next week at 3:30.
It's fresh, funny, inventive.
And I think listeners will find lots to enjoy in them.
The BBC National Short Story Award with Cambridge University on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now the time is 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan. Here is a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
A review of the health service in England commissioned by the government has warned that the NHS is in a critical condition. The surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi, who's now an independent peer, says public confidence has been damaged by repeatedly missed waiting times targets, including for mental health and cancer services. His report says that the problems could take up to 8 years to fix. Sir Keir Starmer will say in a speech today that people have every right to be angry and that the NHS must reform or die. The head of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has described an Israeli airstrike on a school housing displaced people in Gaza as unacceptable. The UN says 6 refugee agency workers were killed in the attack yesterday. Israel says it was targeting Hamas fighters. The first privately funded spacewalk is scheduled to begin within the next hour. The mission's financial backer and American billionaire Jared Isaacman will be accompanied by the engineer Sarah Gillis on the walk. They will also wear a new type of spacesuit. Data centres in the UK are to be added to a list of critical national infrastructure, alongside the emergency services and financial systems, as well as energy and water supplies. The move means they will receive extra support during a major incident, such as a cyber attack, an IT outage, or an emergency caused by extreme weather. Pharmacies, pubs and banks made up half the closures on Britain's high streets in the first 6 months of this year, according to new data. The accountancy firm PwC says dozens of coffee shops and convenience stores have opened, but not enough to fill the space. There's been success for the ITV drama Mr. Bates vs. the Post Office at the National Television Awards. The programme won Best New Drama, while Toby Jones, who played the former sub-postmaster Sir Alan Bates, won Best Drama Performance. The former postmistress Jo Hamilton, who was wrongly convicted of fraud, called on the government to do more to ensure scandal victims were swiftly compensated, as she was surrounded on stage by fellow victims. The government has said it is working tirelessly to make payments.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. 27 minutes to seven. Let's get straight into that lead story Jane mentions. This huge report by the esteemed surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi published today outlining the very big challenges facing both our national health and our national health service. Hugh Pym is our health editor. Hugh, good morning. Just reading the opening pages of this report, it lays out very, very stark detail the fact that it's not just the health service that's broken, but the nation's health, Hugh.
Well, that's right. Lord Darzi has not pulled any punches here. He does say that although the NHS is in a critical condition, its vital signs are strong. It's not a terminal diagnosis. And he says, even with all his very bleak findings, he thinks it can be turned round. But the job of turning it round will take up to 8 years, between 5 to 8 years, in other words, longer than one parliamentary session. Just running through some of the headlines, waiting lists have swelled, waiting times have surged. He said A&E conditions are awful, with the number of people waiting more than doubling over 10 years, waiting for treatment in A&E units. Cancer Care UK has appreciably higher cancer mortality rates than other countries. Conservative reforms in 2012 did lasting damage to the management capability of the NHS. Money was squeezed from 2010 onwards. Interestingly, on capital spending, that's on buildings and equipment, he says there's a £37 billion gap between what other leading healthcare systems spent on that area and what the NHS did over a decade. And if that money had been there, you could have built your 40 hospitals. And he says one of the reasons that capital spending on buildings and other technology, the importance there is that it helps managers and the NHS become more productive. It's become less efficient, he says, and one reason is it doesn't have the right equipment. And the health of the nation, as he said, has basically deteriorated over 15 years.
So I was just going to say, you mentioned the eight-year time horizon he offers. It's worth saying that Wes Streeting, who we're talking to at 10 past eight, has said that he's due to publish early next year a 10-year plan. So this is an attempt to both, I guess, give some political cover, but also to buy some time.
Yes, I think Aradazi doesn't want to be seen as being all doom and gloom without a prognosis that things can be improved. One of his ideas is that you need to readjust the budget of the NHS in England so relatively more is spent on community care and general practice, which happens to chime with Wes Streeting's ideas. But yes, it'll take time. We're going to be given a 10-year plan for the NHS in England by the government. We might have to wait a little while for that. So that might not be a lot of consolation to patients and staff who've got to get through yet another winter and into next year.
Hugh Pym, our health editor, thank you.
Well, let's take on the political dimension of Lord Darzi's landmark report into the ailing health of the NHS. Leila Nathut here, our political correspondent. Leila, is there a case for blame here as much as looking forward?
Morning, Emma. Well, I think much of what we're going to hear today does chime with everything we've heard so far from the Labour government, trashing the Conservative Party's legacy, this time in particular blaming the 2012 reforms carried out by Andrew Lansley, the then health secretary, and also this idea that Labour has to do this foundational change to make things better in the long term. So yes, there is an idea of kind of what they're going to do next, broadly this idea of making the NHS digital, moving, as Hugh said, from hospital to communities, sickness, focusing instead of people being sick, focusing on how to prevent people getting ill in the first place. I think there's a couple of things that stands out for me. One is that it doesn't seem like Lord Darzi or the government is talking about more money being the answer. That's very helpful, obviously, because there isn't very much. So the idea is that money is going to be sort of budgets are going to be retargeted and incentives are going to be changed within the NHS. On this idea that Andrew Lansley's reforms, the previous Conservative reforms, were catastrophic for the NHS, the emphasis from this government is that they're not going for a major reorganisation as such. So they're going to try and avoid these unintended consequences of the Lansley reforms. It's more like they're going to sort of re-incentivise different parts of the NHS to act in different ways. On prevention, I think there's something quite interesting, this idea of focusing on prevention instead of, you know, treating people once they're ill. yes, that's going to mean potentially more government interventions, but also the NHS is going to have to kind of reorient itself to catching illness earlier and not letting things progress. But I think one of the glaring things for me in this is that there is little mention of social care, even though the Darzi report says 13% of beds in hospitals are taken up by people waiting for social care. There is a parallel plan being worked up for social care, but Keir Starmer today only going to focus on the plans for the NHS, which really needs to be seen in tandem for a long-term plan for funding social care.
We will see. The speech is coming up, but there's a preview and a bit of political context for you from Leila Nath, who are political correspondent. We'll also be hearing from the Health Secretary at 8:10, Wes Streeting. But your experiences of the NHS, could you please keep them coming in? You shared some yesterday. We've got some of those messages. And I'm very grateful. We all are for you sending them in. But if you could get in touch to say what it's been like, you're hearing about waiting lists, you're hearing about treatments, you're hearing about beds being occupied. Perhaps someone in your family has been in a bed and shouldn't have been. Maybe they should have needed social care. We also, has to be said, you know, got some very positive messages yesterday about treatment on the NHS. So what your experiences are right now, today at bbc.co.uk, that's the email address, or get in touch on WhatsApp 0330 123 4346. That's 0330 123 4346. So you can either type a message or send us a short voice note by pressing that microphone icon. It's always lovely to have your voices on the radio, so do get in touch.
Certainly is. 21 minutes to 7, let's turn to the Middle East, because the UN Secretary General has said, and I quote, dramatic violations of international humanitarian law must stop after the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said six of its staff were killed yesterday in an Israeli airstrike on a school it runs in a refugee camp in central Gaza. Let's speak to Daniel Di Simone, who's our correspondent in, sorry, Daniel Di Simone, who's our correspondent in Jerusalem. Daniel, morning from London. What more do we know about what actually happened?
Well, this took place yesterday at this compound in a refugee camp in central Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says the school is home to, has been home to around 12,000 displaced people. And that this was the fifth time during the war that started last October that the school has been hit. They say that six of their staff were killed, and that this is the highest death toll amongst their staff in a single instance since the war began. But that their director general says that actually at least 220 staff have now been killed. The media office in Gaza that's run by Hamas said that 18 people were killed in the strike yesterday. Antonio Guterres had said that this is totally unacceptable what happened, and that these dramatic violations of international humanitarian law need to stop now. And the agency has said that they've called on schools to be protected and that no one is safe in Gaza.
And Daniel, what have the Israelis said about it?
Well, the Israeli military said that they conducted a precise strike against terrorists who were operating inside a Hamas command and control centre in the area. And they say that it was embedded in a compound that previously served as a school, and that it contained Hamas terrorists who were planning and executing attacks against IDF troops and Israel itself. They also say that they took various steps to mitigate the risk of harming civilians. And there's a context to this in that Israel has previously been very critical of this UN agency, critical of its neutrality, said that some of the staff took part in the attack last year by Hamas on Israel, and actually some of the staff were later sacked by the UN after an investigation.
All right, Daniel Di Simone in Jerusalem, thank you very much indeed.
It's 18 minutes to 7. A review of the NHS in England by the surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi has described it as being in a critical condition, and later the Prime Minister will apparently say that the NHS must reform or die. Well, let's turn to events yesterday in Parliament, where Sir Keir Starmer found himself settling into the routine of prime ministerial life, question time in the Commons, and a government defeat in the Lords. Sean Curran was watching.
It was the lunchtime after the night before.
We now come to Prime Minister's questions.
Sir Keir Starmer, having seen off a revolt by his own MPs over plans to end winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners, was cheered by Labour backbenchers when he arrived in the Commons. This was only his third PMQ since winning the election in July. Keir Starmer is still getting used to having swapped places with the, for now at least, Conservative leader Rishi Sunak, and last week repeatedly addressed the leader of the opposition as Prime Minister. At this week's exchanges, Rishi Sunak revealed that when he was in number 10, PMQs had never been his favourite part of the week. Now, in his new role of questioner, he wanted to return to Tuesday's vote.
With that decision debated and made, it is now important that the House understands the full consequences of the government's choice. So can I very specifically ask the Prime Minister, will he now publish the impact assessment before the House rises?
Later today, the Commons will start a three-week break as the three largest parties in Parliament hold their party conferences. The Prime Minister repeated what is now a familiar argument, that the Conservatives had left a £22 billion black hole in the public finances.
Of course, when it comes to mitigations and impacts, we've put those in place, ramping up pension credit, dealing with housing benefit and linking it, something the party opposite didn't do for years. And because of the tough decisions that we're making to stabilise the economy, we can make sure that the triple lock shows that increases in pensions will outstrip any loss of payments.
He thought the former Prime Minister should apologise for the budget black hole. It was starting to get noisy in the Commons.
They're shouting now that those arguments didn't even convince 50 of his own MPs. Who suddenly found that they had urgent business elsewhere yesterday, Mr. Speaker. But we know why he's hiding the impact assessment. The Labour Party's own previous analysis claimed that this policy could cause 3,850 deaths. So are the numbers in his impact assessment higher or lower than that?
Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, we're taking this decision to stabilise the economy. That means we can commit to the triple lock. By committing to the triple lock, we can make sure that payments of state pension are higher and therefore there's more money in the pocket of pensioners, notwithstanding the tough action that we need to take. But he goes around pretending that everything's fine. That's the argument he tried in the election. And that's why he's sitting there and we are sitting here.
The Liberal Democrats also voted against the changes to winter fuel payments. Their leader, Sir Ed Davey, said it was wrong to balance the books by taking money from pensioners. But he agreed Labour had inherited a financial mess from the Conservatives.
One of the many reasons for that mess was the Conservatives prioritising tax cuts for the big banks, costing £4 billion a year.
They pay more tax.
Ed Davey was heckled there by Conservatives. He called on the Prime Minister to reverse those tax cuts and use the money to help struggling pensioners. Keir Starmer said he'd resist the temptation to get ahead of next month's budget. A little later in the House of Lords, a former Conservative pensions minister, Lady Altman, who now sits as a non-affiliated peer, argued that the changes to the winter fuel payments were effectively a cut in the state pension.
For anyone on the old basic state pension who is over 80, £300 is 3.4% of the money they received from the government last year.
She was trying to block the changes by proposing what's known as a motion to annul, but it soon became clear that the parliamentary manoeuvre wouldn't succeed. Lady Stedman Scott for the Conservatives called the cuts a betrayal of pensioners, but said her party wouldn't vote for Lady Altman's motion.
It is not the place of this House to override the decision of the elected House, and that is why the opposition have tabled a regret motion today.
The Labour government later suffered its first defeat in the Lords when Piers backed that Conservative regret motion criticising the cuts to winter fuel payments. In spite of that defeat, the changes will go ahead and they come into force next week.
And you can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on BBC Sounds. Time now is 13 minutes to 7. Data centres in the UK are to be classified as critical national infrastructure, joining the emergency services, finance systems, energy and water suppliers. This means they could get and would get additional government support during a major incident such as a cyber attack. Let's speak first of all to Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor. Morning, Zoe. Why are they doing this?
Morning, Amber. Well, if you use any online services or social media or something like ChatGPT, or you have a photo storage account with Apple or Google or Amazon, or you do online shopping, then the chances are you are using a data center most days, if not every day. If they went down, we would notice. And nothing's been added since this critical infrastructure list since 2015. And that was when space and defence was included. And there have been lots of calls to put data centres on it. The Tories also looked at doing it last year. But let's be clear that this is also a government business decision. Peter Kyle talked to me yesterday a lot about the importance of data centres as an investment asset for the UK. We've got Microsoft and Google, who are both building huge data centres in West London at the moment. And we also heard just the other day that Amazon Web Services is going to spend $8 billion building here in the UK in the next 5 years. So they will get this extra support. And what's really interesting is that there's a lot of carrot and seemingly very little stick at the moment. There won't be any extra regulation imposed on data center operators, and there won't be any extra scrutiny of their existing contingency plans either. Both of those things were described to me as red tape. So it's very clear that this is an incentive to build more data centres here, which we do need, but which also, let's be honest, bring in lots of money.
Indeed. Zoe, well put. Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor. Thank you. Let's turn to Bruce Owen, who's Managing Director of Equinix, which runs data centres. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning, Amol. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, pleasure. Presumably, just to pick up on that last point that Zoe made, presumably you'd argue that there's a very strong economic benefit from this kind of move too.
Yeah, we're really encouraged by the government's recognition of data centers as critical national infrastructure. And, you know, the UK for us as a global data center provider is a critical market. And over our history within the UK, we've invested over £1 billion, and we're very encouraged by this signal. And therefore, it encourages us to continue to invest and serve our customers within the UK.
And what are the sorts of different levels of threat that you have to contend with, Bruce? Because presumably there's obviously a cyber threat, but there's also a physical one.
Yeah. So for us, you know, mainly on the physical side, what we want to be able to do is make sure that our customers, we have 10,000 customers, can put their most critical infrastructure within our buildings and trust that we're going to keep those services up and running. And so the physical side of that security is really important. And that comes with access to how do we make sure we got access to power and fuel and whatever we need to keep these facilities running so that everything that happens within the digital economy can continue to take place, whether that's online learning, whether it's banking, whether it's this, you know, this interview that you and I are doing is happening through a data center. And so it's both the physical and the cyber that is really important to ensure that everything that's digital can operate the way it's intended to operate.
Yeah, we do sort of take it for granted that people like you are going to run it, you know, properly, and we're not going to have any big problems. Do you think most people grasp the actual physical connection required, the actual, if you like, the real life connection between, say, a retailer, a bank, and a customer every time a transaction takes place?
No, I don't think they do. You know, and this appreciation for, as everything moves digital, it actually physically happens and transacts within a building. And that building's a data center, almost like a modern day port where trade takes place. And there's a physicality to it. And so what we do as a company, as an example, is be that connection point of all these service providers or your bank or emergency services or education, online learning, that exchange of information can actually take place within a building. And so there's a very physical presence to everything that happens digitally, and it all takes place within a data center.
And just final thought, this is a fast-growing growth area for this country, isn't it? Especially given Amazon's announcement this week.
Yes, it absolutely is. And the UK, actually, we should be very proud of it, is a really important part within the global economy because of how much traffic, internet traffic, actually flows through the UK. And so this is a really strong signal of the UK saying we want to continue to be a place where innovation takes place, where we're encouraging investment from enterprises to move into the UK and deploy their most critical infrastructure here. And so it is a very strong signal of an encouragement to come and continue to grow the economy within the UK.
Okay.
And it's underpinned, it's the engine room of the economy.
Bruce Owen, Managing Director of Equinix, thank you very much indeed.
At 8 minutes to seven, let's think about how the government should address the amount of sewage in our rivers. Well, this week, the Environment Secretary, Steve Reed, met with roughly 30 people representing private sector investors in the water industry, such as pension funds, in a bid to attract fresh capital. This comes as all 11 water and sewage companies in England and Wales are being investigated by the regulator Ofwat after it expanded its investigation into potentially illegal sewage pollution. And this is at a time when more and more people are struggling to pay their water bills. George Eustace joins us, the former Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Minister and former Conservative MP. Good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, what do you think of this meeting?
Well, I think it's positive because although there's been obviously a lot of political rancour around this issue, we're only actually going to solve it if we can get the new capital investment required. And, you know, 2 years ago in 2022, I set out a very, you know, big plan, really, to invest in improved infrastructure, expected to cost around £56 billion. That's now worked through the system, and the water companies have put their business plans in. Ofwat have given their draft determination, and there's some discussions, you know, about that, which will take place over the next few months. You know, but ultimately, unless we get these companies to the table able to raise the investment, we won't get that sort of £56 billion or possibly as much as £80 billion investment needed to solve this problem.
But there's a lack of trust, isn't there?
There has been a lack of trust, and I think it's because it's been a very difficult political issue for a long time. And you know, one of the views I have here, if I were to do something else, if I was still in place, you know, when you originally had the privatisation of the water companies, there was this idea of popular capitalism, of a shareholder democracy. And one of the ideas was that you know, the water company customers would also be shareholders, and you'd have some shareholder activism. Now, obviously, the advent of private equity, and in fact, some of these companies even coming off the London Stock Exchange, means I think you lost something. You lost that connection with customers. And what I'd like to see is more of these water companies that have come off the stock exchange trying to get a listing there again. And some water companies are doing some quite creative work to try to get their customers to become shareholders. And I think that's a positive thing that Ofwat should be doing more on.
Do you think that water bosses should go to jail if they preside over sewage leaks and dumps?
I personally think on this one, and there was an announcement of a bill last week.
Yes.
The threshold's very high. It's that they have to obstruct an investigation by the Environment Agency. And I suspect that never happens anyway. The real issue here is sometimes the investment's not been there to deal with these challenges. And the other problem
is that they're also happening in the first place.
Yes, that's right. And so some of them are a breach of permit, and there's investigations going on. And in my time, we did a huge fine, for instance, on Southern Water that precipitated a change in ownership of the company. So the powers are there to do quite stiff fines, and those are probably the most relevant powers available to the regulator. But the second thing we need to do here is look at other sources of funding. There's too much really riding on the pricing round process on water bill payers. I think what we need to do, and the government's got big ambitions for planning, is have a collection of an infrastructure levy, maybe up to sort of £5,000 per home, and for that money to be used and brought to bear to sort out street drainage. Because many of the problems we have come from the fact that surface water drainage and street drainage is ending up in the foul water sewer system and overwhelming it. And if we could fix that problem, we'd go a long way to solving the crisis.
I asked the question as well, though, not just because of the bill, but you know, there's also the idea that water company bosses could be banned from receiving bonuses. Do you support that?
Yes, and there's powers there already. So
you don't need new powers, but you do support that, because we haven't seen that happen. There are, you know, those listening who are struggling to pay their water bills, they see sewage issues and spills, and they feel that there's remuneration happening that's huge.
Yes, in some cases. But you've also got a challenge here, which is if you want to attract, you know, some of the best civil engineers to lead these companies and sort them out, you know, if the choice is between working for a water company or working for, say, one of the big energy providers, at the moment, most would go for the latter. And so you've got to be a bit careful that you don't undermine the incentives for good executive performance. But yes, the powers have already always existed for Ofwat to do that. In some cases, they have done that. I think this bill will probably strengthen those powers a little bit, and those may be used. I think the new prison sentences are unlikely to be used, because so they would need to obstruct an investigation. I don't think there's ever been much evidence of that happening, but there we go.
I mean, the evidence of just it happening in the first place that people are very upset about, and what can be used to stop that in the meantime. But it's good to get your views. George Eustace, former Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Minister. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
3 minutes to seven, here's Stav with the weather.
Thanks very much, Amal and Emma. Good morning to you. Well, the weather's in a chilly phase right now. Cold northerly winds bringing air right down from the Arctic. Wednesday won't be quite as strong as what we had yesterday. We should see fewer showers around. There'll still be quite a few through the afternoon. And a few could also be heavy with some hail and thunder. High pressure, though, starts to build in from the southwest for tomorrow. And that'll cut off that northerly airflow. So slowly, temperatures will begin to recover back closer to normal as we head into the weekend. But that will bring a change with outbreaks of wind and rain for Scotland and Northern Ireland. Today, though, for much of the country, it's a cold start with some patches of frost around here and there. Lots of sunshine, but we have showers from the word go across northwest Scotland, Northern Ireland, northwest England, North Wales. These showers will bloom and become more widespread into the afternoon. Like I mentioned, some will be heavy with some hail and thunder. Winds not quite as strong, so if you're out of the showers and in some sunshine and some shelter, it won't feel too bad. Though temperatures remain below the seasonal norm, ranging from 9 to 13 degrees across Scotland and Northern Ireland, 12 to 16 or 17 for England and Wales. It's going to be a cold night tonight with the clear skies tomorrow, feeling a touch warmer.
Oh, I hope so. Thanks, Stav.
On BBC iPlayer.
I'm on a train. It's the Glasgow to London night sleeper service.
Brand new drama.
I think we may have a problem.
There's been a hijack-in. Hijacks are so 20th century.
We're being controlled remotely.
This train is now a guided missile.
One of the passengers may be working with the hackers. Don't trust anyone.
You're never getting off, are we?
Night Sleeper departs on Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
Well, coming up after 7 o'clock, they've delayed that historic spacewalk. They must have known that Emma was going to be narrating it live.
It would just be
too much jeopardy for Radio 4 listeners. But we'll look ahead to it with Astronomer Royal for Scotland, Professor Catherine Haymans.
You're listening to Today with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. Good morning. It is 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 12th of September. Good to be with you. Good to have your company. The headlines. Sir Keir Starmer is to warn that the NHS must reform or die after a review of the health service in England concluded it was in a critical condition. The United Nations says an Israeli strike on a school building in Gaza killed six of its staff in the single deadliest attack for UN workers since the war began. And an American billionaire is preparing to go on the first ever privately funded spacewalk more than 400 miles above the Earth. The BBC News on Earth, read by Jane Steele.
A new report warns that the National Health Service in England is in a critical condition. The surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi, who's now an independent peer, conducted a rapid review for the government. He said the problems could take up to 8 years to fix. Sir Keir Starmer will say in a speech today that the NHS must reform or die. More details from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
Lord Darzi, summarising his report, said the NHS in England was in a critical condition, but the vital signs were strong. He said public confidence had been damaged by repeatedly missed waiting times targets, people were struggling to get GP appointments, and A&E was in an awful state. On finances, the report argues that spending on buildings and equipment before the pandemic was inadequate, and there was a £37 billion shortfall compared with other leading international health systems. If the money had been available, the maintenance backlog could have been tackled and 40 new hospitals funded. Lord Darzi had this message for staff and patients.
We just need to put the right investment in the NHS. We need to engage our amazing staff and look at the whole pathway, as we've done before, from the cradle to the grave. What does it mean to the patients? What can we do to improve?
Sir Keir Starmer will today set out the government's response, stating that the 2010s were a lost decade for the NHS. He'll say that a 10-year plan will be drawn up with fundamental reform and the biggest reimagining of the NHS since its birth.
The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has accused Israel of dramatic violations of international humanitarian law after the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said six of its staff died yesterday in an Israeli airstrike on a school it runs in Gaza. Hamas officials said at least 18 people were killed. The Israeli military said it had conducted a precise airstrike on terrorists operating in the camp. From Jerusalem, here's Daniel DeSimone.
Antonio Guterres described what was happening in Gaza as unacceptable.
The UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees said yesterday's strike on a school had been the single deadliest incident for its staff since the start of the war between Israel and Hamas in October last year. The agency's Commissioner General, Philippe Lazzarini, said at least 220 of its workers had now been killed. The agency said the school in Nuzarat was home to around 12,000 displaced people and had been hit five times during the war, adding that no one was safe in Gaza. The Israeli military said it had targeted terrorists planning attacks from a Hamas command and control centre embedded in the compound, and that it was a further example of the systematic abuse of civilian infrastructure by Hamas.
An American billionaire is hoping to attempt the first ever privately funded walk in space. The Polaris craft left Earth on Tuesday with Jarek Isaacman, the commander of a four-strong crew. The spacewalk was scheduled to begin in the next half hour, but has now been delayed until later this morning. Our science reporter Georgina Ranard has more details.
Three, two, one, ignition. It sounded like a standard space launch, but this mission hopes to make history. If all goes to plan, the billionaire Jared Isaacman, who funded this Polaris project, will shortly perform a spacewalk with the engineer Sarah Gillis. The crew will put on a new type of spacesuit that can be worn inside and out of the craft. The suits mean its doors can fully open, with no need for an airlock inside. The two crew members should then step out and walk, 435 miles above the Earth's surface. All space travel is risky, but this is particularly dangerous. Just one of the crew has been to space before, and this is the first test of their equipment.
Data centres in the UK are to join the emergency services, financial systems and energy and water supplies as critical national infrastructure. The change means they would receive extra support during a major incident, such as a cyber attack, an IT outage or an emergency caused by extreme weather. This report from our technology editor Zoe Kleinman.
Data centres are enormous warehouses full of banks of computers. They carry out a wide range of digital services, from data processing and storage to powering AI tools and social networks. Most people will perhaps unknowingly connect with a data centre every day. US tech giants including Amazon Web Services, Microsoft and Google are investing heavily in building new UK-based sites. The new protection being offered by the government will include a team set up specifically to monitor and anticipate potential threats against them. There won't be any new regulation or scrutiny of the data centre operators' existing emergency plans. The security services have warned that state actors, including Russia and China, continue to try to sabotage UK infrastructure.
The family of the jailed Belarusian opposition leader Maria Kolesnikova say they fear she's being slowly killed in prison after 18 months of solitary confinement with insufficient food. She's serving an 11-year prison sentence for leading protests against President Lukashenko in 2020. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
No one has heard directly from Maria Kolesnikova for 18 months. No calls, letters or prison visits are allowed. So the only news comes when other inmates get out. And their latest reports are so worrying, Maria's sister says she is slowly being killed during months on end of solitary confinement. The opposition activist needs a special diet after an operation for a perforated ulcer. But she's not allowed extra parcels or cash, so she's lost a dramatic amount of weight. Her sister Tatiana told the BBC she believes the situation is now critical. So she's calling on Western governments to pressure the Belarusian authorities to release Maria, one of the best-known faces of the giant protests in 2020 against Alexander Lukashenko's authoritarian rule.
The former president of Peru, Alberto Fujimori, has died at the age of 86, just 10 months after he was granted a pardon and freed from jail. He was forced from office in 2000 after 10 years in power and was later convicted of corruption and human rights abuses and sentenced to 25 years. A charity which promotes the national parks of England and Wales for the public benefit says vital environmental work is being held back because nearly 90% of protected landscapes are in private hands. The Campaign for National Parks says more could be done to safeguard nature if the park authorities were given greater rights and resources to buy up private land. The government is currently reviewing powers for national parks. Here's our rural affairs correspondent Malcolm Pryor.
It was 75 years ago that new laws paved the way for the creation of Britain's 15 national parks. These landscapes are run by special authorities with a legal duty to conserve and enhance their natural beauty. The Campaign for National Parks says that aim is being undermined because those authorities actually own little of the land and have little real influence over those that do. It's calling for a new People's Charter that would give the authorities more resources to buy and manage the land directly. But the Country Land and Business Association, which represents 28,000 rural businesses, says farmers do work hard to protect habitats.
A famous 1941 black and white photograph of Winston Churchill staring resolutely at the camera has been found 2 years after it went missing from a hotel in Canada. Police tracked the portrait to a private buyer in Italy who was unaware it had been stolen. A man has been arrested in connection with the theft, which wasn't noticed for more than 6 months, as Kat Wiener reports.
The iconic roaring lion image was taken by the renowned portrait photographer Yusuf Karsh when Churchill addressed the Canadian Parliament during the Second World War. It hung in the reading room of the Fairmont Chateau Laurier Hotel in Ottawa for decades until it was taken and replaced by a fake. Staff noticed the original was missing months later, in August 2022. Ottawa police say the global hunt for the photo was one of the most complicated cases they'd ever worked on, involving forensic analysis, tips from the public, and support from international organisations. The much-reproduced photograph is one of the most famous images of Churchill and features on the £5 note.
Kat Wiener reporting.
Jane, thanks very much. It's 9 minutes past seven. This morning's historic spacewalk, which was due to happen in the next few minutes, has been delayed. It is still going ahead, we're told, but will now take place just before 11 o'clock this morning, our time. The American fintech billionaire Jared Isaacman, who founded a payment firm, has taken off in a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, with SpaceX employee Sarah Gillis is planning to step out of their Crew Dragon spacecraft for a two-hour float in space at an orbit of 700 kilometres, nearly double the altitude of the International Space Station. Aptly, the spacecraft is called Resilience. No human has been that far since NASA's Apollo programme ended in the 70s. Professor Catherine Haymans, Astronomer Royal for Scotland, joins us now. Who better to guide us through than potentially this historic morning? Hello.
Good morning, Emma. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to correct you off the bat already.
What have I done?
They're actually going to be out in space for just 15 minutes
15.
Each. Okay. Jared's going to go first and then Sarah will follow. The whole spacewalk will take 2 hours, which includes venting the spacecraft, them going out, coming back in and then repressurizing it. So they'll only be out for about 15 minutes. Sorry to correct you.
No, again, it's important. It's a two-hour float, but 15 minutes each out. Understood.
Out of space, yeah.
But this is a tell us why this is such a moment, potentially.
Well, this is the first commercial spacewalk. So as you said, it's being funded by Jared Isaacman, and he has a vision. He's been quoted as saying he wants to see an armada of ships arriving on Mars. So he's got this big vision of space exploration, and the key thing to get there is to understand how safe it is for humans. So this is a really risky expedition. It's not something that NASA would do themselves for astronauts, because they are sending these astronauts out into a very radiation-dense region of our solar system, a place called the Van Allen Belt, where there are zones of really highly energetically charged particles that are dangerous for the humans. So there are 40 experiments on board, mainly focused on testing human health and how the body responds to this very dangerous environment.
So there's quite significant risk today, or how would you calibrate that?
Yeah, so the other thing that's really risky, these are brand new spacesuits. So I'm not sure if you've watched the movie The Martian, Emma, fantastic Matt Damon walking around on the surface of Mars in quite a lightweight spacesuit. Now, the NASA spacesuits that you're used to seeing are very chunky. It's very hard for the astronauts to move inside those spacesuits. And so they're going to be testing brand new SpaceX technology that's been redesigned from the ground up, really focusing on those joint mobility. So when we see the astronauts coming out of the spacecraft. It's going to be, I think it's going to be quite fun to see them. So Jared's described this as it's going to look like he's doing a little dance because they're going to be checking out the mobility of these brand new, much more flexible spacesuits. So that's going to be fun to watch, but also at the same time, really risky. It's the first time that these spacesuits have been used in outer space. So, but it's great to see this new technology being developed and tested, although high risk for the astronauts involved.
I think that's what I'm feeling slightly uncomfortable about, and maybe I shouldn't be, but the idea that this is high risk, you know, the idea NASA wouldn't do it. Of course, you can also argue that's where commercial elements come in, where you get to take bigger risks and people are willing to do that. And it's not on a government or public funding in that way. But when preparing oneself to watch this, you know, are you also nervous?
Yes, I mean, any journey into space is risky. It's very risky. We have actually at the moment there are the most humans in space than ever before because we have this new Polaris Dawn crew up there. We've got the Chinese astronauts on their space station, and we've got extra astronauts on the International Space Station at the moment because the Boeing Starliner astronauts are still up there. So any journey into space is risky. I kind of see this like the explorers of old. You know, the first explorers who went down to the Arctic, to the North Pole, the first people who tried to climb Mount Everest. They knew it was risky, but they wanted to push themselves, push human civilization to these new feats of endeavour. This one is, you know, I'd love to see humans exploring the solar system, but it's incredibly dangerous, the radiation. We're protected here on Earth by our fantastic magnetic field. Mm. And the further you get away from that protection, the more dangerous it is for our health. So it's going to be interesting to see what data they collect to see just how dangerous it is. I'm still looking forward to seeing this this space dance. So you can start watching live.
You're tempering my excitement with this. Sorry, you're going to say you can watch live after, what were you saying?
After, so the live feed starts about 10 o'clock. Okay. You can watch it on X if you're on X, but there are also YouTube versions that are mirroring it.
X, formerly Twitter. Professor Catherine Haymans, Astronomer Royal for Scotland, lovely to have you on the programme on this day, which could be a historic one. If the spacewalk does happen, as now planned later this morning, you can hear the details on World at One.
It's 7:15. Be warned, the Met Office has said this autumn will be wetter than usual, and that's after the 18 months to this February were the wettest on record. It might be timely then that a new floods resilience task force, which aims to accelerate the development of flood defences and generally improve resilience to extreme weather events, is being announced today. It will bring together the Environment Agency with several Whitehall representatives and also emergency responders and the National Farmers Union, among others. The Executive Director of Flood and Coastal Risk Management for the EA, for the Environment Agency, is Caroline Douglas, and she joins us now. Ms. Douglas, good morning.
Good morning.
Why has this task force been set up?
Well, the task force itself has a dual purpose. And so in the immediate short term, it's about making sure we're prepared and resilient for winter, so bringing together government and industry and at national and local levels. But then longer term, having an oversight of the wider flood resilience strategy and investment programs that are in place, all about making sure that we have better protections in place for people, property and businesses in over the future.
What are the big errors or failings of recent years that we've made, which you think we need to correct?
I think we always need to learn from what we've done in the past and how we can improve. So actually we do have a really good track record of having better protected over 90,000 properties with our flood defences that we've built since 2021. So we've done some good work there. But we also know that we need to ensure that people know what to do when we have a flood. So making sure that people are signed up to flood warnings, know where to look on gov.uk to see those flood warnings. So there's all sorts of things that we need to continue to build on and work with to better protect communities in the future and to help them as to help themselves as well.
Flood defences cost billions of pounds. There's already over £5 billion committed to this. Are you confident you've got the funding that you need?
Well, as any government official will tell you, it's always lovely to have new funding, but we The intent is that we make sure that we can stretch what funding we have as far as we possibly can to invest it in those areas that are most at risk and to continue to invest it wisely in the future. And the benefit of this task force will be to help guide us on that better investment. And so in addition to the billions of pounds we've spent on flood defences, we've also spent hundreds of millions of pounds maintaining the 76,000 flood defences that we have.
Well, you see, that the reason I ask you that is because, I mean, I don't want to land a minute, but we had a former Environment Secretary on this programme about 20 minutes to go, and he was saying, not at all in an accusatory way, but he was just saying one of the things you've got to, I was asking him about this new task force, and he said one of the things you've got to look out for is just to make sure these sorts of task forces aren't in fact used as a cover for saying that instead of having the capital investment that you need, instead you're going to load the issue onto households and say, well, households need to better improve their flood defences. So are you confident that this sort of task force is not actually going to be used to say we haven't got the money for the very expensive flood resilience we need?
Well, this task force is about looking, making sure that we're investing the money that we do have in the right way and making sure that it is going to areas that are more resilient, but also looking at what other options we can use in the future, because we also need to be open to other innovations that are coming forward, which is working and working at a range of levels. So the task force is bringing together representatives at government as well as business and industry and a range of stakeholders. So it is looking across the board. It's not just looking at individuals.
All right, Caroline Douglas from the Environment Agency. Thank you very much indeed.
At 19 minutes past seven, let's turn our attention to business, because the owner of John Lewis and Waitrose has this morning reported an improved financial picture, but outlined pretty significant challenges ahead for those John Lewis department stores, which some of you will know and care about. Will Bain is back with more. Will?
Good morning again, Emma. Yeah, always slightly difficult to pull apart these numbers because a supermarket bit has been going very well, very nicely for quite a few years. Been more of a struggle for those department stores, as you say, that are such a feature of so many of our listeners. High streets, I'm sure. John Lewis PLC, the overarching company for both, reported it narrowed its losses this year. Pre-tax loss down from £56 million to £29 million. But as I say, the picture a bit different for the two main brands. Diane Whirl, CEO and retail analyst at Rendell Intelligence and Insights, is with us. Diane, morning.
Good morning, Will.
On John Lewis, first of all, then, sales down in the first half of the year quite significantly, 3%. And they talked about, you know, the challenge to squeeze on all our budgets, big household items and things like that they weren't selling as many of.
Yes, I mean, the picture hasn't really changed for John Lewis over the year. I've actually looked at the first half of last year and sales were down 2% in the first half. And they make great play of saying that the majority of their uplift comes in the second half. Well, it doesn't seem that we're going to see that. And they are challenged by better competition. Marks and Spencers have really upped their game. They admit they've struggled with fashion, and that's across the high street. Fashion sales have been very poor. Beauclair, who tracks sales in high streets, have seen fashion sales drop by about 7% over the past 12 months. So fashion is a big key thing for John Lewis, and they're struggling there with increased competition and the likes of, you know, a better offer from M&S.
In terms of upping that game and matching that competition, some interesting tie-ups that they've announced today, isn't it? What they're calling investing in their in-store offering, bringing in Gales Bakeries and Waterstones bookstores into the department store.
Yes, I mean, that's trying to diversify, trying to drive people into store, make them stay longer. If they stay longer, they'll spend. And that's great, but actually it's not going to significantly move the dial. They really have to go back, offer really good brands, go back to where they were. And unfortunately, that competitive landscape has shifted now. So they are in a more difficult position than they once were.
A quick look at Waitrose. Strong numbers there again. Sales up, prices, they said, were up 2% as well, which was interesting. And also going to roll out these convenience stores, these smaller stores, 100 of them.
Absolutely. I mean, Waitrose has been the shining light. And, you know, this is a very familiar picture. We have, you know, we saw this with M&S, you know, in the years that M&S clothing was struggling, their food was strong. And likewise with John Lewis, they have a great offer. They used to have some smaller stores, pulled them out, and now they're going back. So, and actually, they're very suited to have small stores because a lot of their offering is designed in smaller portions. So it makes sense. But of course, they're a strong brand to start with, and that just will reinforce it.
Diane Well, CEO and retail analyst at Rendell Intelligence and Insights. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much indeed. 22 minutes past seven. A London council is threatening to ban Lime bikes. They are the electric bikes for hire, which have become prevalent in some of our cities. And they're threatening to ban them because of the nuisance that they're apparently causing with poor parking, and they're being hacked by vandals. Lime bikes, you may know, they're those green and white self-hire bikes which you can pick up using an app. The council in question is Brent. Its leader is Mohammed Butt, who joins us now. Mr. Butt, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, well, pleasure to have you on. Why are these bikes annoying you, or rather some of your residents?
It's not just some of our residents, quite a few of our residents, right? The nuisance they're causing now, right, in relation to just being dumped on the streets and our parks and our rivers and our canals, right, outside our high streets, they're just being sort of left, right, with no care and attention. And Lime do need to take some responsibility because it's their users who are causing that nuisance.
And when you say they're causing nuisance, is it that people are getting they're kind of an eyesore? Are they getting in people's ways? Are they actually causing physical damage? Are they promoting crime? Yeah. What sort of problems?
We had a 77-year-old woman who was knocked over by a Lime bike by a 12 or 13-year-old kid who'd managed to hack the bike and was just riding down the street. Lime have no idea who are using their bikes once they're hacked, right, because they're so easy to hack, right? Anyone could go onto TikTok or anything else, right, and take a look at how to hack one of those Lime bikes and start using those bikes. It's their bikes, right? They need to take some accountability, responsibility for making sure, right, that their assets are kept safe and secure as well, right? But it shouldn't be to the detriment of our residents in Brent, right? It shouldn't be to the detriment of people trying to get to work or trying to go to school, walking down the street, going to the shops, trying to use our parks, and that's what's happening at the moment.
But as you'd expect, in a spirit of fairness and accuracy, we did approach the company, and they said that they can enforce mandatory parking rules in Brent, but first we, as in Lime, need the council to build a functional network of parking locations. They say we can provide data and funding to support this process. We want to work with them on this. Banning bikes won't help anyone. What do you say to that, Mr. Butt?
What I say to them is we have been working with them. We have identified 100 spaces across Brent, right? We're also working with the likes of TfL, who have given us funding to work with them to create at least 20-25 spaces. And they're saying, right, that they need hundreds and thousands of spaces. Well, that's not a problem, right? But like any other road user who parks on our roads and spaces, right, they make a contribution, right, towards some of those spaces. And that's what we're asking. Work with us, right, but make the contribution to create those spaces, right? And if you want those hundreds and thousands of spaces, it takes time. I have to consult with residents, right? We're putting in the low traffic neighborhoods across our schools, making them safe. If you're not going to work with us, right, we are going to end up in this situation, right, where we will say to you, right, that you're not welcome, right? As we've said, right, people have gone sour on Lime.
And do you actually have the power? You say, I mean, that's a very clear position. You say, if you don't work with us, if we don't fix this, then, it's game over. Do you actually have the power to stop Lime bikes being used in your council?
This is one of the other things, right, that we're working on. I have three MPs, right, Dawn Butler, Barry Gardner, and Georgia Gould, right, who know the position, and we're asking them, right, to make representations at the highest levels, right, in government to give us the power and the authority that we need. We're also working with London councils across all London councils to come up with a memorandum of an understanding and agreement, so we have a uniform agreement. But we can use highways powers, right, where these bikes are causing a nuisance, right, to remove them. And we would expect Lime, right, to be a responsible a player in the market, right, to work with us and to take the bikes off the streets where they are causing a nuisance.
Mohammed Butt, leader of Brent Council, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us this morning.
27 minutes past seven. Simon's back with the sports.
Thank you, Emma. England's men's cricketers fell to a 28-run defeat to Australia in the opening T20 of their series in Southampton. The tourists were bowled out for 179. Travis Head top scoring, with 59. In response, Liam Livingstone top scored for England with 37, as the hosts were all out for 151. Let's move to tennis. And Great Britain began their Davis Cup Group D with a 2-1 victory, with debutant Billy Harris and veteran Dan Evans winning their singles, before Finland grabbed a win in a tight doubles rubber. Let's speak to our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller, who is in Manchester. Russell, good morning to you. Let's start with Billy Harris and an impressive debut for a player with quite an interesting backstory.
Morning, Simon. Yes, it looked like this was an opportunity that would never present itself. He had never won a match on the full ATP men's tour before last October. That was just a couple of months shy of his 29th birthday. And his ranking has, for the most part, been outside the world's top 200. So you wouldn't expect to be playing Davis Cup with a ranking like that. And he made a living and earned ranking points by driving around Europe in a transit van for 3 or 4 years. There was a bed in the back. He used to cook by the roadside, stocking up on food at a supermarket in Dover before heading over to Europe, parking up in restaurant car parks so he could borrow their Wi-Fi, and often driving 2,000 or 3,000 miles at a time, including one journey from the south of Spain to Poland, which involves stopping in Switzerland for a swim in the lake and a little wash on the way to his next tournament.
I mean, that does speak to the power of perseverance. Dan Evans, the veteran of the side, produced the goods to wrap up the tie, as he so often has on Davis Cup duty. But that doubles defeat might yet come back to bite Leon Smith's side.
It's possible that at the end of the week, the four teams in the group are hard to separate. And in particular, the three stronger nations, Canada, Argentina and Great Britain. And if they had the same number of wins in the round robin stage, it would come down to the tennis equivalent of goal difference. And then matches won, and even sometimes sets and games won, can be significant. So in losing the doubles, it was only a 2-1 victory for Great Britain rather than a 3-0 victory. And they will need to be very, very sharp in the next tie, which is against Argentina on Friday. Although there is a chance that if they beat Argentina and Canada were to beat Finland today, then actually Canada and Great Britain could qualify for the knockout stage of the finals in Malaga in November with a round to spare.
And just finally, Russell, no Jack Draper yesterday, rested after reaching the semi-finals of the US Open, but you expect him to see him back for those ties?
I think so. Leon Smith will very much want him to play on Friday, because Argentina have got three singles players in the top 35 and they've got a very good doubles pair who play together regularly on tour. He has been practicing on Tuesday and Wednesday, only arrived in Manchester on Tuesday lunchtime, and he's tired, as you can imagine, after reaching the US Open semi-finals. There's physical fatigue, there's emotional fatigue, there's jet lag, there's a little bit of tightness in his right leg. So I think it was only realistic that he probably wouldn't play yesterday, and all things being equal, would be brought into the team later in the week.
Russell Fuller, many thank you. That match, the next tie, will be tomorrow, and we'll have more on that and all the other top stories. They're available on the BBC Sport website.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. Later today, we'll hear John Wilson in conversation with an award-winning author.
I read everything. I thought books were keeping secrets from me.
Booker Prize-winning novelist Marlon James is my guest in our 100th episode of This Cultural Life this week. He takes us back to school days in Jamaica, where he first fell in love with literature, and reveals his diverse artistic influences, from Kurt Cobain to Charles Dickens.
He was really good at creating this sort of universe of people who work their way into your skin. To this day, I am still terrified of Bill Sykes.
Marlon James, talking to me, John Wilson, for This Cultural Life this morning at 11 on Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds, where you can also hear my 99 previous guests.
99, there you go. A look at the weather. Today will be cool and breezy with sunny spells and scattered showers. The showers may be heavy across the south in the afternoon, with the risk of thunder locally. Showers largely easing by the evening.
Coming up in the next half hour, as Lord Darzi's report into the state of the NHS is published, we will hear from one of this country's most revered medics, Sir John Bell. And Kate Winslet speaks to us about her new movie, looking at the life of Lee Miller.
Absolutely fascinating. I didn't know nearly enough. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's 29 minutes to 8. Let's get a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
A review of the NHS in England commissioned by the government says the health service is in serious trouble. The surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi, who's now an independent peer, was asked to carry out the review when Labour won power. He says the health of people has deteriorated over the past 15 years and warns that the problems could take up to 8 years to fix. The Prime Minister will set out a 10-year plan for the NHS in a speech today. The Conservatives say they will look at the report carefully. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described an Israeli airstrike on a school housing displaced people in Gaza as unacceptable. The UN said six refugee agency workers were among the people killed in the attack yesterday. UNRWA said the school in Nusayrat had been hit five times since last October. Israel said it was targeting Hamas fighters. The family of the jailed Belarusian opposition leader Maria Kolesnikova say they fear she is being slowly killed in prison because of insufficient food and extreme isolation. No one has heard directly from Ms. Kolesnikova for 18 months. She's serving an 11-year sentence for leading anti-government protests. The first privately funded spacewalk is now scheduled to get underway later this morning. It had been due to start in the past few minutes. The mission's financial backer and American billionaire Jared Isaacman and the engineer Sarah Gillis are due to spend around 15 minutes each on the walk, more than 400 miles above the Earth. They will also wear a new type of spacesuit. Data centres in the UK are to be added to a list of critical national infrastructure, alongside the emergency services and financial systems, as well as energy and water supplies. The move means they will receive extra support during a major incident, such as a cyber attack, an IT outage, or an emergency caused by extreme weather. Police in Canada say a famous portrait of Winston Churchill, which was stolen from a hotel in Ottawa 2 years ago, has been found in Italy. The photo, which was taken in 1941, had been replaced with a fake. Hotel staff didn't notice the original was missing until 6 months later. A man has been arrested.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. 26 minutes to eight. Reform or die. That is Sir Keir Starmer's message about the NHS to be delivered in a speech later today. It's a message echoed on several front pages. And it's occasioned by the publication of a report by Lord Darzi, a former Labour minister, esteemed surgeon, which lays out in arresting detail the sheer scale of the problems, not only with the National Health Service, but with our national health. At 10 past 8, we'll be speaking to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, to analyse some of the problems, solutions and potential trade-offs. To set that up for you, here is Sir John Bell. He's also one of this country's most venerated medics, Regius Professor of Medicine at Oxford University, and someone who's advised British governments for many years. He was speaking to me and Nick on this week's edition of the Today podcast, which is available now on BBC Sounds and elsewhere.
So there are two models. Crank the handle faster, which is, I think, the model that many people would argue you need to do. My view is that's really hard because as you throw more people in to crank the handle, the efficiency of the system just falls away. You know, let's train an extra 20,000 doctors. That was a plan of the last government. And I just said, well, you know, it's like sending more guys into the Battle of the Somme. You're not going to get any more ground. You're just throwing more people into a system that doesn't work. My personal view is that is not the model. You've got to have changing roles. People have to do differently. We have to move things to the community, try and keep things out of hospital wherever we can, and use a whole range of innovations to do that.
I just want to push you a bit, John, on this. You can't crank the handle.
Yeah.
You can't just pour in more doctors. Because people might just think, well, hold on, there's a set level of demand. We know what the backlog is. So we just hire some more doctors. And yes, that might mean more bits of kit, scanners for cancer, for example, or modernised buildings. And then we get back to where we were, they would think, under the Blair government, which inherited quite a big problem when it came to backlogs and managed pretty much to clear it over a period. Why can't that be done?
So there's an acute reason why it can't be done, and that is that in the midst of all the expansion of the workforce and activity in hospitals, we'd forgotten about capital expenditure. So there's a massive backlog in terms of hospitals, hospital beds. There are hospitals falling over all over the country, and somebody's going to have to fix that. And then if you look at things, for example, we have the least number of scanners, of MRI scans, CT scans. We have the tiniest number of the bits of kit you need to take the first step to look after people. If you want to crank the handle faster, you can't do it without the bits of kit. Better diagnostics, better lab facilities, better radiology facilities, and better and bigger hospitals.
Is the NHS underfunded, John?
So I think it is not underfunded, to be honest. I think we need to get better using the money that's in it. We did run a healthcare service for actually many of my early years when I was a practicing physician, which was profoundly underfunded. And the outcomes weren't bad. You know, people do pretty well. But then over the last 5-10 years, we've been pumping up the amount of money going into the NHS. So when you look at as a comparator, as a percent of GDP, we actually spend more money than Spain. We spend more money than Japan. We spend more money than a lot of developed economies that have healthcare systems that deliver much better outcomes. So the answer is not, in my view, pouring more money or indeed pouring more people into the system.
Can Wes Streeting get these reforms through?
I hope he can, actually. I genuinely
believe. Hope is a different thing. And I like
what does bitter experience?
Yeah. What's the evidence that he can? Because hope is a marvellous thing and we all need it. But can reform of the NHS actually happen?
Well, I think we've reached a point where people in the NHS are going, oh my God, we got to change this. And we've got patients who are saying, a lot of patients say, look, they did a pretty good job on myself or my mother or my sister, but then there are lots of examples where they've actually done a terrible job. So that dissatisfaction is coming out in the polls. People are saying, actually, I love the NHS, but I'm now really not very happy with it. So I think the momentum to do something bold is there. It won't be without difficulties, but I think it's never been better positioned for a big dramatic step.
Are the difficulties the doctor unions? Because most Secretary of States I've known, Labour as well as Conservative, end up going out of doing that job swearing about the BMA. I mean, just saying.
Well, I'm not a member of the BMA, so I can say this. There is a problem that the incumbents, who are the doctors in the BMA, have been a major drag on reform of healthcare. If you're thinking about eggs you're going to have to break, I'm afraid the stranglehold that the medical professions broadly to have on the way we run a healthcare system is going to have to be sorted.
Give a specific. What's an example?
There was a new drug developed for lowering people's cholesterol called inclisiran. And what's really nice about it is you can get an injection and it lowers your cholesterol by 50% for a year. Don't need to remember to take the statin tablets. Well, it turns out that only 30% of people who get prescribed statins take them. And there was a deal done with the company who made it. It was called the Medicines Company, that the NHS would get it, because the NHS did a lot of the trials, would get it at an absolutely bargain basement price, the cheapest ever. And the NHS got very excited and said, we're going to roll out doses of this to 700,000 people in the first year. And it got to the GPs and they said, sorry, guys, we're not going to do this.
Why?
Well, they're not getting paid enough for the injection that they were going to give. And they blocked it. Absolutely in its tracks. And
they would presumably have said, it's yet another. They said,
yet another.
Coming from above.
Yeah, that's right.
We've got
enough
to do already.
And by the way, we're busy and we don't have time to give the injections. I think that the medical profession is locked into a way of life and a way of practicing medicine. But they are deeply conservative and they're very hard to move to a different place. So just wait till you start trying to replace pathologists with AI reading of slides. Moving innovation into the system does require not just push, it needs pull. And the guys who have to pull it are the docs.
Well, we put what Sir John Bell said about the BMA and about the medical profession to the BMA. And the BMA responded by saying it has, and I quote, has been at the forefront of calling for the reform of our health service needs, addressing its crippling staff shortages and enabling doctor skills and expertise to be utilised to their full. You can hear the full conversation with Sir John on the Today podcast on BBC Sounds. And our special guest this week is actually Al Murray, most famous as the pub landlord, but also a massive Second World War buff.
19 minutes to 8. Well, talking of the Second World War, our next guest has spent the best part of the last decade working on a film that tells the story of a woman we may think we know, but really we don't. I'm talking about Kate Winslet and her first time in both the producer's chair and lead role. Her subject, Lee Miller. Most, if you know anything about Lee Miller, remember her as a Vogue model and muse and lover of the surrealist artist Man Ray in her younger years. But Winslet has turned her attention to Miller's pioneering work as a war correspondent and photographer, and one of the very few women to make it to the front line during World War II, defying expectations of her sex. She captured harrowing and important images while at the liberation of Buchenwald and Dachau concentration camps, and was famously photographed in Hitler's bathtub at his apartment in Munich after his death. Lee Miller died in 1977, and the film, called Lee, is based on the lives of Lee Miller, a book by Anthony Penrose, referred to in this interview as Tony, her only child from her marriage to the surrealist artist Roland Penrose. Anthony worked closely with Kate Winslet on the film, granting full access to his mother's personal archives and diaries. And when I spoke to Kate Winslet yesterday, I began by asking her what drove her to dedicate almost 10 years of her life to Lee Miller.
The reason I wanted to make the film was because I wanted to lift her out of the male gaze. You know, when I first started Googling Lee Miller, I knew a bit about her, sure. I had a couple of books about her. I had books that included photographs of her as a model. But I did not know this Lee. I really didn't. And when I first Googled her in 2015, the first thing that comes up is, and you said the words yourself, former muse of Man Ray, ex-model, Vogue cover girl, these labels, you know, and we do like to label women. But these labels that existed even then, and they exist for women still now, which does drive me mad because we don't use those labels for men. But Lee was described in a sort of almost infantilizing way. And I thought, hang on a minute, hang on. That was a sliver of her life in her 20s. She lived a whole life way beyond that time. And she hated being a model. She always said, I'd rather take a picture than be one. And
it's quite a journey, isn't it, to go from, you know, being the subject in that way to, you know, what she ended up photographing, the liberation of Buchenwald and Dachau, you know, the front lines of the absolute most, you know, unimaginable horrors of World War II.
Yeah. And I'm sure she didn't know what to expect. I don't think she was naive. I think Lee Miller was born with her eyes wide open. Who of any of us, of anyone who witnessed the atrocities of the Nazi regime, who could ever have known what they were to be met with when they walked through the gates of Dachau or Auschwitz? Who could possibly have known? But what Lee did do that sets her photography apart was not to photograph the soldiers and the bloodshed and the actual fighting. She didn't do that. Other war correspondents were sent there to do exactly that job. But Lee was in a position where she could follow her nose, and she'd spent her life being extremely good at that and being very instinctive and also being extremely restless. And she talked about that, you know, oh, I'd stay here much longer if it weren't for my damn itchy bottom, she would say. And that's how she would describe this sort of restlessness in her that even she herself couldn't really understand. She was unique because when you use a Rolleiflex camera, and of course, I had to learn how to use one myself quite well. The Rolleiflex camera, for listeners who don't know, it is not a camera that you hold up to the eye. There is a facility that you can do that, but it's a square, rather heavy camera. And actually, typically, a Rolleiflex photograph is taken from just between the heart and the stomach, is where it sits on the body. And you look down into the camera at the image, at the person or object or scenario that you are photographing. But what that means is that once the light meter has been read, the settings are in place, the focus is perfect, it means that Lee can then look into the eyes of the person she's photographing. She can observe the situation. She can really step into the same world as that person, to really immerse herself in what she was documenting.
One of the photos that is very famous of her at this time, as opposed to when she was a model, I just wanted to understand from you how you read into it, how you spoke about it with her son, which is her decision to get into Hitler's bathtub and be photographed. What's going on there?
Listen, at that stage of things, they had not changed their clothes for 6 weeks. This is true. They hadn't changed their clothes for 6 weeks and they hadn't touched hot water for 6 weeks. Okay. So they walked into the gates of Dachau and they were there to bear witness, which they did. And then from there, they drove to Munich. Lee knew where Hitler's Munich apartment was, a bit like Downing Street. People know where it is. So she drove to Prinz Regentenplatz, which is the address where his apartment is, and there was a guy on the door keeping guard, and Lee, using her wiles, would have bribed him with a carton of cigarettes or a bottle of half a bottle of brandy. She was very, very good at finding the things that she really needed to keep her going. And she made her way in. And it's true that when they got into the apartment, there was an entire regiment in there having a party. And then they discovered there was a bathroom. And there are many photographs of other people using that bathroom, you know, soldiers, GIs having a shave. I myself can perfectly well see how, as a woman in that situation where she hadn't had any clean knickers for 6 weeks, can you imagine turning that tap on and going, oh, it's hot water? So I think there was something in her that just thought, well, it's, it would be logical to take a bath. And we decided that once she was in that bath, then she realized this is a photograph that no one else is going to get or even think of or even dare to take. But Lee had that in her. She was a risk taker. She really was. She took chances, you know, she took a risk going to the front line. First of all, anything could have happened to her. And secondly, she didn't know if it was going to work out. She didn't even know if she was going to get in the door. And we see that. She gets to the field hospital in Normandy and she's told no women in the press briefing after finally getting the accreditation to go. But Lee was Lee, and she saw things and did things her way. And I've just never come across anyone like her.
I just had to ask you while we were talking, because I feel even since we last spoke to each other, when I asked you about whether children shouldn't have smartphones or not, you were very clear saying you didn't want to be a celebrity telling people how to live their lives, but no, you don't think that they should. And it really has ramped up now. You know, smartphone-free childhoods are campaigns right across the country. I just wonder what you make of the direction of travel.
It's phenomenal. It's enormously heartwarming. Just, I think, if for no other reason than parents perhaps are communicating properly about it, and perhaps people feel a little bit less alone with how much they may have struggled or how much they were fearing it should that time come. I mean, still now I do have conversations with people who say, oh God, Kate, what are you going to do? You know, oh, dreading these next few years. You know, what do we do? She's already asking for a phone. I mean, they're only 10, or, you know, she's turning 11. And those conversations are still happening. But what I do find surprising is that the people in power aren't just doing more.
Would you like to see our new Prime Minister ban smartphones for children?
I mean, I think it's a combination, isn't it, of people in power, yes, politicians, but the big tech companies.
Kate Winslet there talking to me about her new film, Lee, telling the story of Lee Miller.
10 to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend Dr. Michael Banner, Dean and Fellow of Trinity College in Cambridge.
Good morning. Somewhat unexpectedly, I would say, cats have achieved a certain prominence in the US elections. After the presidential debate on Tuesday night, Taylor Swift, a self-professed childless cat lady, endorsed Vice President Harris. Meanwhile, in the debate itself, Donald Trump's assertion that Haitian migrants in a city in Ohio are eating the dogs, they're eating the cats, prompted some immediate fact-checking, not in his favour. And the moderators had to come to the rescue of the truth on a few other occasions as the evening went on. Taking a 30-year perspective on truth and politics can seem discouraging. Back in the 90s and noughties, spin seemed to be what politicians were chiefly suspected of, glossing a story in the most favourable way. We seem to have moved on from spin to outright and, at best, careless falsehoods. The truth seems more in jeopardy now than back then. Of course, in a longer perspective, the truth has always been at risk. There are no cats in the Bible, but there are politicians, and perhaps the most consummate and admired is King David. Yet even David needed the help of a moderator to keep the story straight. The prophet Nathan confronts David with an artful tale about a rich man stealing a poor man's sheep. For the sake of getting David to admit his wrongdoing in taking Bathsheba from her husband Uriah, disposing of Uriah in battle the meanwhile. Psalm 51, the most penitential of the Psalms, is traditionally headed a Psalm of David when Nathan the prophet came to him after his adultery with Bathsheba. And it imagines David now possessed of the most clear-sighted self-assessment. I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. From self-serving and delusional denial to utter clarity, Nathan's fact-checking is stunningly effective in eliciting a confession of error. We've yet to see that on camera. But what this story says to me is just that the falsehoods that really bind us, the ones that are most difficult to overcome, are not the falsehoods which politicians and ordinary people carelessly or cynically tell to try to win a debate, smear a rival, or simply to get out of a hole. The more tricky and the more sticky lies are the ones we tell ourselves, so desperately wanting them to be true that we can fool even ourselves, not just others, into believing them. Around our lives, our motives, our characters and our intentions, we can tell the most self-serving stories, vice versa with the lives and motives of others. The hardest task is not to fact-check other people, but to learn the disciplines of self-examination and confession, which enable us to fact-check ourselves.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Michael Banner. Time now is 7 minutes to 8.
Nature restoration in the UK's national parks is being held back because nearly 90% of the land remains in the hands of private owners. That is the claim of campaigners. Have a listen to this. Guy Shrubsole is from the Campaign for National Parks.
What I'd really like to see is for ministers to update the legal purposes of national park authorities so that restoring nature is their primary mission, and give them the power and resources to buy more land. And I think if you look at the ideas that informed the creation of our national parks, you know, you go back 200 years to when William Wordsworth, the poet, was talking about the Lake District and talking about it, how it should be treated as a sort of national property. I think that's the sort of dream that we need to finally make a reality.
Well, 75 years ago, new laws that paved the way for the creation of Britain's 15 national parks came in. These landscapes are run by special authorities with a legal duty to conserve and enhance their natural beauty. The campaign, though, that you've just been hearing says that aim is being undermined because the authorities own little of the land and have little real influence over those that do. Does Kevin Bishop, the chief executive of Dartmoor National Park, agree with that? He's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Where are you with this, this accusation, really?
There's no doubt that we need to do more for nature, but we also need to do more for people, don't we? Our national parks were designated to protect our finest landscapes and provide opportunities for all parts of society to enjoy them. But they're working landscapes. Dartmoor is home to 34,000 people living within the national park. 90% of it is farmland. We need to do more. To do more, we need resources, finance, we need new powers, we need new tools. Land acquisition could be one of those tools. I would be dead against compulsory land acquisition. Almost everything we do in partnership with others, and there's a real power in partnership working.
But what, you know, where's this coming from then? If I just, sorry to cut across, this frustration that there isn't enough being done and this call for changing of ownership?
I think there's no doubt that there's greater potential for doing delivering for nature. We, the National Parks of England, have worked out that we could deliver 20% of the government's nature recovery targets on 10% of the land if we had the right tools and resources. We've been starved by previous governments in terms of our resources. You know, our budgets have been cut by almost 50% in real terms. If you gave us the tools, the resources, we could fly. There's unlimited potential of our national parks, not just to deliver for nature, but also to reach out to all parts of society. What we would like to see is the government renew the People's Charter that underpins national parks. This was the phrase used by the Labour government when they came to power post-war.
But without ownership, even with more money, and you know, I have to say, working on this programme and across so many different stories, and the call for more money, not least we're about to talk about the NHS, is loud and loud, you know, and louder still. Even with more money, if you don't have the ownership, can you really do what you're talking about?
Ownership doesn't necessarily give you control. So Dartmoor National Park Authority, with 100% capital grant from government, purchased 850 acres of common land in March this year. Because it's common land, it means that farmers, graziers have rights to graze cattle on that common. We need to work with those commoners And we want to work with those commoners to influence the management of the land. So land ownership in itself is not the panacea. Partnership working, having the right resources, the ability to give advice, to be able to lead through that advice is the way forward. We've got 30% of the national park now being managed under landscape recovery schemes. That's landowners and farmers, which we are supporting. That, I think, is the way forward. Certainly not compulsory land acquisition. Land acquisition itself through the free market has a role to play.
Kevin Bishop, Chief Executive of Dartmoor National Park. Thank you.
3 minutes to eight, and to the weather and staff.
Thanks very much, Amal. Good morning to you both, and good morning to you at home. Well, it's chilly at the moment. This cold snap not expected to last beyond Friday as we cut off the Arctic airflow as high pressure starts to build in on Friday. And then by the weekend into next week, temperatures will recover. We could see quite a bit of sunshine around, particularly England and Wales, where temperatures will be into the low 20 Celsius again, and nights will be milder too. So we've got another chilly day in store. It has been a very chilly start for many areas, with even close to a touch of frost in a few rural spots, central northern England into parts of central Scotland. But there's more of a breeze there to stop a frost from developing, and a lot of sunshine around. However, we've got plenty of showers, northwestern Scotland, Northern Ireland, northwest England, North Wales. And these showers have been coming thick and fast into the Cheshire Gap. So parts of Cheshire, Merseyside, southern Lancashire, seeing the rainfall totals really mounting up. Could see some localised flooding in places. A lot of standing water on the roads this morning, so do take extra care. Elsewhere, it's a dry start, but showers will get going as we head into the afternoon as temperatures begin to rise. And like yesterday, some of them will turn out to be heavy with hail and thunder. But I don't think we should see quite as many as we had yesterday. And one thing today you'll notice, the wind's not quite as strong either, so I don't think it'll be quite as chilly. However, temperatures still below the seasonal norm, 9 to 13 degrees for Scotland, Northern Ireland, 12 to 16 for England and Wales. That's your weather.
Thanks very much, Sav.
It's been a summer of spectacular concerts from the BBC Proms, with stunning performances and unique collaborations. Culminating in the world's biggest classical music party. The last night of the Proms. Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
Coming up after 8 o'clock, how do you fix the NHS? Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, joins us live. We're going to go through the problems, the solutions and the trade-offs involved.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. Good to be with you today. Hello, it's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 12th of September. The headlines this morning. Sir Keir Starmer is to warn that the NHS must reform or die after a review concluded that the health service in England was in serious trouble and letting patients down. The United Nations says an Israeli strike on a school building in Gaza killed six of its staff in the single deadliest attack for UN workers since the war began. Former sub-postmasters are urging the government to speed up compensation for victims of the Horizon IT scandal after the ITV drama Mr. Bates versus the Post Office was the biggest winner at last night's National Television Awards. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
A new report warns that the National Health Service in England is in a critical condition. The surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darzi, who is now an independent peer, conducted a rapid review for the government. He said the problems could take up to 8 years to fix. Sir Keir Starmer will say in a speech today that the NHS must reform or die. More details from our health editor Hugh Pym.
Lord Darzi, summarising his report, said the NHS in England was in a critical condition, but the vital signs were strong. He said public confidence had been damaged by repeatedly missed waiting times targets, people were struggling to get GP appointments, and A&E was in an awful state. On finances, the report argues that spending on buildings and equipment before the pandemic was inadequate, and there was a £37 billion shortfall compared with other leading international health systems. If the money had been available, the maintenance backlog could have been tackled and 40 new hospitals funded. Lord Darzi had this message for staff and patients.
We just need to put the right investment in the NHS. We need to engage our amazing staff and look at the whole pathway, as we've done before, from the cradle to the grave. What does it mean to the patients? What can we do to improve?
Sir Keir Starmer will today set out the government's response, stating that the 2010s were a lost decade for the NHS. He'll say that a 10-year plan will be drawn up with fundamental reform and the biggest reimagining of the NHS since its birth.
Sir John Bell, who's Regius Professor of Medicine at Oxford University, told us the health services problems were too complex to fix solely by recruiting more doctors and other staff.
You know, it's like sending more guys into the Battle of the Somme. You're not going to get any more ground. You're just throwing more people into a system that doesn't work. My personal view is that is not the model. You've got to have changing roles. People have to do differently. We have to move things to the community, try and keep things out of hospital wherever we can, and use a whole range of innovations to do that.
The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has accused Israel of dramatic violations of international humanitarian law after the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said six of its staff died yesterday in an Israeli airstrike on a school it runs in Gaza. Hamas officials said at least 18 people were killed. The Israeli military said it had conducted a precise airstrike on terrorists operating in the camp. From Jerusalem, here's Daniel De Simone.
Antonio Guterres described what was happening in Gaza as unacceptable. The UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees said yesterday's strike on a school had been the single deadliest incident for its staff since the start of the war between Israel and Hamas in October last year. The agency's Commissioner General, Philippe Lazzarini, said at least 220 of its workers had now been killed. The agency said the school in Nuzarat was home to around 12,000 displaced people and had been hit five times during the war, adding that no one was safe in Gaza. The Israeli military said it had targeted terrorists planning attacks from a Hamas command and control centre embedded in the compound, and that it was a further example of the systematic abuse of civilian infrastructure by Hamas.
Data centres in the UK are to join the emergency services, financial systems and energy and water supplies as critical national infrastructure. The move means they would receive extra support during a major incident, such as a cyber attack, an IT outage or an emergency caused by extreme weather. Bruce Owen is from Equinix, which runs data centres. Speaking on this programme, he welcomed the move.
We're really encouraged by the government's recognition of data centers as critical national infrastructure. You know, the UK for us as a global data center provider is a critical market. And over our history within the UK, we've invested over £1 billion. And we're very encouraged by this signal. And therefore, it encourages us to continue to invest and serve our customers within the UK.
The first privately funded spacewalk is set to take place in just a few hours' time. The Polaris Dawn mission is being led by the American billionaire Jared Isaacman. He and his crew will study the effects of radiation on the human body in the hope it will help pave the way for space tourism. But Scotland's Astronomer Royal, Professor Catherine Haymans, told us the mission was very risky.
It's not something that NASA would do themselves because they are sending these astronauts out into a very radiation-dense region of our solar system where there are zones of highly energetically charged particles that are dangerous for the humans. The other thing that's really risky, these are brand new spacesuits. It's the first time these have been used in outer space.
The former president of Peru, Alberto Fujimori, has died at the age of 86, just 10 months after he was granted a pardon and freed from jail. He was forced from office in 2000 after 10 years in power and was later convicted of human rights abuses and sentenced to 25 years. Here's our South America correspondent, Ione Wells.
Alberto Fujimori remained a divisive figure in Peru up until his death. He was jailed for corruption and human rights crimes and known for his iron fist approach to leadership. His supporters credit him with stamping out a left-wing guerrilla insurgency and putting the economy back on track after skyrocketing inflation. His critics saw him as a dictator whose tenure was remembered for human rights abuses and corruption. His daughter announced his death. She runs a right-wing populist political movement, has run for president three times, and had been expected to run again at the next election.
John Lewis has reported pre-tax losses of £30 million for the 6 months to July, nearly half what they were in the same period last year. The firm's department store business saw half-year sales fall 3% to £2 billion, but its Waitrose supermarkets achieved sales growth of 5%. The ITV drama that renewed interest in the post office IT scandal was the biggest winner at last night's National Television Awards. Mr. Bates versus the Post Office was named Best New Drama, and Toby Jones won Best Drama Performance for his portrayal of the former sub-postmaster Sir Alan Bates. The series had already received the NTA's Impact Award. On the stage at the ceremony in London, Joe Hamilton, who was wrongly convicted of fraud, said many of those affected were still waiting for compensation.
I went to Westminster a couple of weeks back and saw the new minister. And trust me, nothing has changed. And out of the group of 555, more than 300 haven't been paid yet, including Sir Alan Bates. They've offered him 30% of his claim.
The government said it was working tirelessly to provide compensation and that almost £300 million had been paid out so far. Animal rights campaigners have accused the Ministry of Defence of wasting taxpayers' money on the ceremonial bearskin caps worn by the King's Guard. The group, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, says it has obtained figures showing that the cost of each hat has risen by 30% in a year to £2,000, and it's calling for fake fur to be used. Here's our royal correspondent, Sean Coughlin.
One bear is needed to make each of the distinctive tall black bearskin caps worn by the King's Guards outside Buckingham Palace. Campaigners from PETA say there should be a move to fake fur, not just on ethical grounds, but because of the soaring cost. The group says it's wrong that taxpayers have spent more than £1 million on the fur caps over the past decade. The Ministry of Defence says it's open to switching to fake fur, but only if a suitable alternative can be found that's sufficiently durable and can keep its shape. It's a decision for the military rather than the royals, but Queen Camilla, earlier this year, revealed that she was switching away from buying real fur.
A famous 1941 black-and-white photograph of Winston Churchill staring resolutely at the camera has been found 2 years after it went missing from a hotel in Canada. Police tracked the portrait to a private buyer in Italy who was unaware it had been stolen. A man has been arrested in connection with the theft, which wasn't noticed for more than 6 months, as Kat Wiener reports.
The iconic roaring lion image was taken by the renowned portrait photographer Yusuf Karsh when Churchill addressed the Canadian Parliament during the Second World War. It hung in the reading room of the Fairmont Chateau Laurier Hotel in Ottawa for decades, until it was taken and replaced by a fake. Staff noticed the original was missing months later, in August 2022. Ottawa police say the global hunt for the photo was one of the most complicated cases they'd ever worked on, involving forensic analysis, tips from the public, and support from international organisations. The much-reproduced photograph is one of the most famous images of Churchill and features on the £5 note.
Taylor Swift has taken home 7 trophies at the MTV Video Music Awards, becoming the most awarded artist in the ceremony's history. They included the prizes for Video of the Year and Best Collaboration, bringing her to a total of 30 awards, beating the 27 won by Beyoncé.
Jane, thank you. The time now is 8:10. With its two-tone, bureaucratic blue, somewhat anodyne title of Independent Investigation of the National Health Service in England, the cover of Lord Darzi's 163-page report published today doesn't really do justice to the urgency and scale of the problems described inside. Here is a very brief snapshot of his findings. These are quotes taken from pages 3 and 4. Waiting lists for community services and mental health have surged. A&E is in an awful state. People are struggling to see their GP. Waiting times for hospital procedures have ballooned. Cancer care still lags behind other countries. The NHS budget is not being spent where it should be. Productivity is too low. The context for all of this is that our health as a nation, and again I quote, has deteriorated with lower healthy life expectancy, a sharp rise in mental health problems, and a huge dropout from the workforce due to long-term sickness. And of course, the number of people aged 85 or over in this country is likely to double in the next 25 years. A wonderful but very expensive change. Darzi is a former Labour minister commissioned by a Labour leader, but if that Labour leader was looking for some political cover to undertake, as it were, radical surgery on the NHS, these findings might be it. Wes Streeting is the Labour Health Secretary who joins us now. Mr. Streeting, good morning.
Good morning.
So I wonder if we could do this in three sections. So first, your thoughts on the main findings and then get onto the possible solutions and finally discuss the trade-offs and the money involved. Does that sound good?
It's so polite of you to ask, but I think you're going to do that anyway, and that's the right thing to do.
Well, I just want your consent anyway, so let's proceed. Why is it then? Why is it that despite the NHS getting more money and more staff, its productivity has fallen?
Well, it's a bit like British Airways employing loads of pilots but not giving them planes to fly. If you look at the productivity challenge in our hospitals, it's not the fault of the staff. It's the fact that they're working with creaking, outdated IT systems. They're working in crumbling estate in lots of areas. And you talk to any hospital leader and they will tell you that the reason you've got queues of ambulances out the front door of the hospital is the same as the reason you've got one in seven hospital beds filled with someone who's medically fit for discharge but can't go home. And that's because in the community, whether that's primary care and GP access, or whether it's in social care and community services in terms of delayed discharges, the solutions lie outside of hospitals. And that's why, in terms of Labour's reform agenda, we are making it clear that the status quo is not an option of mismanaged decline, nor is simply pouring ever-increasing amounts of taxpayers' money into a broken model. We have to do recovery and reform. The investment has to go alongside reform. And that was the big challenge that the last government ducked. And that reform is about hospital to community,
analog to digital, and treatment,
sickness to prevention.
And sickness to prevention, absolutely. And everyone agrees that the NHS needs to be less of a sickness service, more of a health service. Just one of the big, big focuses of Darzi's report is very clear, page after page. He talks about the fact that there's been this big shortfall in capital spending. Mm. Just to be clear, what's your analysis of how the spending on workers, because there's been a lot more of that, but spending on workers rather than capital has created these problems?
Well, what happens is this vicious cycle where day-to-day spending in the NHS balloons out of control because the money isn't going into the right areas and because we fail to invest in the estate and the kit that staff need. So you end up raiding capital and tech budgets to plug gaps in day-to-day spending, which then continues to balloon even further because you haven't invested in the capital and tech. And the Chancellor and I are determined, even against this challenging backdrop in the public finances, to make sure that around the budget and the spending review, that we are dealing with that central productivity challenge. And that's why the Prime Minister is setting out today, in stark terms, in his speech on the future of the health service, that investment must come attached to reform, because otherwise you end up doing what the last government did, which is pouring ever-increasing amounts of money into hospitals and scratching your head wondering why the outcomes are still worse.
Very keen to get some specific examples of that reform. Just before we do that, the final big problem that Darzi identifies, which I want to understand your thinking on, is why it is that we've got 2.8 million people in this country who are economically inactive due to long-term sickness, a rise of 800,000 on pre-pandemic, most of that accounted for by mental health conditions. What's going on there?
I think we've got a sickness in our society. I think that we've got deaths of despair, particularly amongst young men, which we should be deeply anxious about as a society. I think we've got a situation where because people are waiting on NHS waiting lists for physical treatment and they're off work and they're struggling, it has deleterious consequences for their mental health too. And fundamentally, that comes back to the point about the shift from sickness to prevention. We will fail in the long term and end up with a country that, you know, rather than having a country with a national health service, we have a national health service with a country attached to it. And actually, more likely, the NHS will go bust if we fail to flatten the curve of cost and demand in the longer term. So I've got two challenges as our new health and social care secretary: to confront the immediate crisis staring us in the face today, but also to take the right long-term decisions to make sure that we've got an NHS that's not just back on its feet, but fit for the future. And that's the challenge the Prime Minister and I are facing up to.
Let's talk about some of the specifics of what you're going to do on that reform agenda. We asked our listeners to get in touch with their experiences. It should be, you know, frank and say many of them got in touch with very positive accounts of their treatment, and you've been positive about aspects of your own treatment.
Definitely.
When you had cancer, which I know informs your thinking. One listener, Ian, told us about how he recently suffered a persistent cough, which turned out to be pneumonia. He said he had the most brilliant care for 4 days, and that carried on post discharge. He said it was an NHS at the top of its game. But this is another one of our listeners called Mike. He was referred for a knee replacement last August, and here he's explaining how he's still waiting for an operation.
I received different information on each time I spoke to someone. In fact, even speaking to the same person, I'd get different information, different timescales. It restricts completely what I do. Although I'm 68, I'm still an outdoor activities instructor, and it's prevented me from either leading groups of young people or, in fact, training other instructors to do the same thing. So I'm quite restricted in that. But in my private life, it restricts how I travel. I find negotiating the stairs difficult, any hills and so on are difficult. It just really restricts what I do.
So let's really rattle through some specifics here, Mr. Streeting. What are you going to do immediately to get waiting lists down for people like Mike?
Well, we've already started by negotiating a deal which junior doctors are now voting on to end the strikes. That is a precondition for the conditions in which we can start busting the backlog without ongoing disruption. I did that within 3 weeks. We are also working with the NHS to stand up at pace, the 40,000 more appointments every week. And by the way, not just more appointments, but linked to reform, evening and weekend clinics, and following tried and tested examples. If I think about my local hospital, King George in Goodmayes, consultant-led clinical team there, busting the backlog through changing the way their clinics operate, and effectively in hospitals that are pioneering this, using Formula One style processes to get more patients through. It's a really good example of how reform can deliver better bang for the buck. If I think about the Maudsley in South London, they're doing some pioneering work on making sure that people who are suffering from mental ill health are also supported in employment, which is adding to their stress and anxiety, to help them not just back to health, but back to work. If I look at what's going on at Leeds, world-leading, non-invasive, knife-free kidney cancer treatment. I mean, that is groundbreaking. And to your point about the contrast between those who have great experiences of the NHS and those who don't, we're facing up to both. And on the ones that do have a great experience, therein lies the hope about the future of the NHS. The reason why reform will work is because we are already seeing exceptional pioneering practice. I've got to make the everyday the ordinary practice, taking the best of the NHS to the rest of the NHS, and that's how we'll reform it.
Sorry to interrupt. Let me ask you about some of those specifics around reform. Will you close hospital beds to shift and redirect money towards prevention?
Bed capacity is actually a real challenge. That wouldn't be the right short-term thing to do, but I am committing to growing primary and community care services as a proportion of the NHS
and
budget.
Will you redirect money currently earmarked for the workforce towards capital spending?
We've got to do both. I mean, on the workforce front, we've got to make sure that we've got the right people in the right place. And actually, that's why I am emphasising primary care, more GPs. I've already acted, by the way, to put 1,000 more GPs on the front line by the end of this year. On community services, it's things like more district nurses in people's homes, not just thinking about nursing as ward-based nurses, but care closer to people's homes. That's a good example of how, you know, that shift from hospital to community will deliver not just better outcomes for patients, but better value for taxpayers.
And here's some numbers for our listeners, which you'll be familiar with. This is how much this country spent on health and social care in the last few years. 2019-20, 157 billion. 2020-21, same again, but 47 billion extra for COVID. 21-22, it rose to 162 billion plus 40 billion for COVID. In 22-23, it rose very substantially. We're talking tens of billions of in increase here to 185 billion. Will that trajectory continue? In other words, will we spend more on health and social care next year than we did this year?
I think the challenge is to start bending the curve of demand and cost for the longer term. And this is why...
What does that mean? Are we going to spend more or not, you think?
Well, in the spending review, the focus of the Chancellor and I is going to be improving productivity in the system. In the longer term, I've got to reduce demand on the health service because, as I say, if we're not careful and we just keep on assuming that we spend ever-increasing amounts of taxpayer money on the NHS, it will overwhelm the public sector dwarf other areas of government spending, and we will end up with an NHS with a country attached to it rather than a country that has an NHS. And I'm conscious of the fact, especially against the tough choices that the Chancellor and the government faces, every penny that goes into the NHS that's wasted is a penny that could have gone into housing, one of the social determinants of ill health, or could have gone into early years education, another social determinant of ill health, or could have gone into poverty reduction measures, a major determinant of ill health. And that is why I'm being so tough on the system to deliver value for money, because every penny that goes into the NHS is a penny that could have gone into social care or any other area of government spending, including defence in a turbulent world. So we've got to make sure that every penny that goes in is well spent. And that's why I'm proud both of the tough choices the Chancellor's making, but also of the emphasis she is instilling across the government on making on sure that every penny of taxpayers' money is well spent.
And I know you'll want to be very diplomatic when talking about the doctors, but Professor Sir John Bell, who we heard from earlier in this programme, said the following to the Today podcast this week. He said, and I quote, "There is a problem. The incumbents, who are the doctors in the BMA, have been a major drag on reform of healthcare." Have they?
Well, let me contrast the conversations I have with people on the front line about reform, who are, let me tell you, I do not find resistance in the NHS. People are crying out for change. And I have some good conversations with the BMA, actually, on reform. And I think there's a real possibility, having settled the junior doctors dispute, to rebuild that sense of professional partnership. I contrast that with some of the sabre-rattling we've seen from the BMA's GP committee, where despite the fact we put £100 million into GP unemployment in the first 6 weeks of this government, and our determination to grow primary care and general practice as a proportion of NHS budgets, we still see sabre-rattling, the unnecessary threat of collective action, which, let's be clear, would harm patients and put more burden on their colleagues in other parts of the NHS. I don't think that's where GPs are, actually. I think GPs want to work with this government. They can see the seriousness of our intent, and GPs really care about their patients. They want, as we do, to rebuild the family-doctor relationship. Okay, I urge the BMA to work with us on that and stop the sabre-rattling.
We'll pick that up with the BMA when we next speak to them. For now, Wes Treating, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
23 minutes past eight. Let's turn our attention somewhere completely different, because on April the 30th in 1980, six heavily armed gunmen burst into the Iranian embassy on Prince's Gate, overlooking Hyde Park in London. They took 26 hostages, including embassy staff, visitors and three British citizens. A very tense six-day siege ensued as millions gathered around screens across the country to see what would happen. It ended on May the 5th, 1980, when the SAS stormed the embassy on the orders of the then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher after a hostage was killed and his body dumped out of the front door. This is how the BBC's Kate Adey covered the story.
I'm listening. I've got a mic. A few minutes ago, there was a massive explosion from the back of the embassy at about 7:24. A pall of smoke rose from the roof. There were shots fired, and about 30 seconds, 45 seconds later, a second explosion.
Kate Adey there. Ben McIntyre, the historian and best-selling author of books including Operation Mincemeat, A Spy Amongst Friends, and now, about this particular episode in history, his latest book, The Siege, has just joined me. Good morning.
Good morning.
And in a moment, I'll be talking to Sim Harris, a former BBC staffer, sound recordist, who was taken hostage in that siege because he happened to be at the Iranian embassy applying for a visa. Sim, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us as well. Ben, I'll just come to you first. There have been programmes made about this, lots written as well, not least as Sim has written about this. But what have you been able to look at this time?
Well, this story immediately became part of our national mythology. It became part of a kind of folklore story. And often it was seen as a rather simple story of kind of derring do versus wicked terrorists. Actually, the real story is much more complicated and much more interesting than that. These gunmen were Arab Iranians who were bitterly opposed to the Iranian regime. They were fighting the Ayatollah Khomeini, and they were bankrolled, trained, by Saddam Hussein. This was a sort of precursor to the Iran-Iraq war. It really didn't have that much to do with British politics, but it came absolutely straight into a kind of mythology about Margaret Thatcher, among many other things. And I wanted to try and unpick that myth, if I could, slightly, and sort of take a closer look at what really happened inside that building over those incredibly tense 6 days.
How have you been able to do that?
Well, for the first time, and I've been extraordinarily lucky, the Ministry of Defence has given authorization for the surviving SAS soldiers who took part in that assault to talk to me. And that's been fantastically useful. There's an old joke that goes, if everybody who claimed to have been involved in the Iranian embassy siege had been there, the balcony would have fallen off. The reality is that actually very few people were involved in that attack. There were only 32 soldiers. Many of them are no longer with us. And I think the SAS rightly wanted to capture their memories while there was still time and to try and get a sort of closer to what really happened. And the last 11 minutes, Operation Nimrod, as it was called, was an astonishing assault. I mean, it wasn't just on the front of the building or indeed just on the back of the building. They attacked the building from six different areas, and the chances of success were actually very low. Thatcher was told there was likely to be 40% casualties.
And that wasn't obviously what happened, for people who don't know.
No, it was really remarkably bloodless. I mean, that said, another hostage was killed in the gunfire. Five of the six gunmen were killed. But actually, given the amount of bullets and gas and smoke and the building was on fire, the survival rate was absolutely astonishing, including Sim Harris.
Sim, good morning.
Morning.
What is it like for you to have this come up again and hear some more and find out some more detail, perhaps, about how it was for the SAS?
Well, it's fascinating, but it's something I've lived with since the siege. It doesn't go away. I get some approach nearly every year, even in recent years, to tell the tale or to give advice. It just won't go away. It's become a bit of a national event, unfortunately, for me.
And how your memories of that rescue, your memories of how it came to an end, what can you say of that?
Well, I found myself on the balcony. I'd been negotiating with the police about a coach to Heathrow. They were doing that as a distraction. Suddenly, everything went black and explosions, and I found my way through a room onto the balcony. Extremely frightened, and on the balcony I found what I thought were frogmen almost, but I was in a complete panic and not thinking straight. Fortunately, the SAS tell you exactly what to do, otherwise God knows what I'd have done.
And what did you have to do?
Well, I had to stay flat on the balcony, although I could see an easy route of escape to my right hand side. Every time I tried to do that, they threatened to shoot me and to stay flat. Eventually, they said, look to your left. And there was a frogman across on another balcony who called me across. And that's what I suppose I lovingly call my balcony scene, as I hopped over the flagpole and back into the embassy, which I thought was total madness because it was all burning by this stage. Some of my clothes were burnt. And then through a room, and I believe I was heading over bodies, onto the stairway out down with other hostages. And the SAS were, I didn't know it was the SAS, no idea at the time, these men were literally throwing us out without any ceremony at all. Girls were just being chucked between soldiers and out onto the back lawn and then thrust on my face and tied up with a cable tie.
So it's certainly a route to survival, and there's much more to say on that and your particular story. But thank you for going back and giving us some of your recollections there, because I think what's coming out here, and especially because of how you've come at this story, Ben, is the SAS and what we didn't know, what we do know, and there's sort of superhero status.
Up until this moment, the SAS was virtually unknown in this country. I mean, 99% of people would never have heard of the SAS.
Really?
And overnight, they became a celebrity organisation. They became incredibly famous. Foreign governments began trying to borrow the SAS for hostage training. They were thrust into the limelight in a way that some in the regiment still find difficult, because they've ever afterwards, they have wrestled, I think, between the tension between their celebrity status and the need for secrecy. Special operations only work if they are done in the shadows. And the SAS was no longer in the shadows. They became a household word. As John le Carré put it, they were sort of action man personified as they abseiled down the side of the embassy. But again, that is a very sort of simple take on what they were. Actually, these were all human beings. They all had their own stories, just like the hostages, just like Sim. And Sim is far too modest to say this, but he's not only an incredibly brave man, he was a wonderful reporter. And throughout this experience, he was taking notes of what was going on. As he escaped with his jacket smouldering inside his pocket was his daily diary. And I've been so lucky to have access to that kind of detailed material to try to really reconstruct what actually happened.
Sim, I wanted to come back to you. Is there something you wanted to add there? Because, you know, again, you can't underestimate how many times people will either go back to this story, like you say, or not know anything at all.
Yes, it's I get very frustrated when people get the facts wrong. You know, there were 80 hostages or, you know, the dates or something like that. I'm a bit of a stickler for accuracy. And although I'm happy to cooperate with research and films and such like, I won't do it unless it's going to be done properly. And I'm very impressed with Ben's book. It is the definitive book on the siege, in my opinion. Well, very, very good.
It's out today. You couldn't have a better mutual appreciation of each other, it seems. It's good to be able to talk to you, Sim. Thank you for coming on, Sim Harris there. And Ben McIntyre, the author and the historian. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's 28 minutes to nine. Here's Simon with a sport.
Thanks, Amol. A somewhat new-look England men's cricket side fell to a 28-run defeat to Australia in the opening T20 of their series in Southampton. The tourists were bowled out for 179 in the first innings, with Travis Head top-scoring with a 23-ball 59. The Australian left-hander took particular glee in plundering England all-rounder Sam Curran's first over. Every ball a boundary.
Curran in again, left-arm angle, and Head likes it once more, and it'll be four this time. 4-4, 6-6, 6-4, off one Sam Curran over.
England did recover somewhat with some leg spin, but they never really got hold of their chase and were all out for 151. So let's talk to the former England T20 World Cup winner, Ryan Sidebottom. Now, morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone.
You took more than 1,000 career wickets in your career. In your view, what sort of impact would that Travis Head over have had on Sam Curran?
Well, I wouldn't call it impact. I would say it had a massive impact in terms of the game situation and how it gained Australia massive momentum. And as England lost to Australia by 28 runs, you would argue that that was a game changer. I think on Sam Curran himself, personally, it's one of those things. I think bowlers now, you know, it's very difficult, you know, small boundaries, flat tracks, the ball's not doing very much. And Travis Head is a world-class batsman, and that can sometimes happen. What you have to do as a player is just come back stronger and make sure that you're switched on and you're ready to go for the next game, because sometimes these things do happen. So you've got to come back stronger and fight for your, you know, fight for your bowling the next time you bowl.
England did manage to change the momentum briefly with some spin with the ball, but they couldn't capitalise, could they?
No, I thought the middle over periods can be very crucial in T20 in terms of batting or bowling, you know, who can get on top of the spin or the medium paces or the guys that can take wickets and nullify the opposition or the batting attack. So I thought England did pretty well. But they didn't quite go on, did they? And I think Australia had all the answers. I think if you look at, you know, with the debutants, England looked just a little bit behind. You know, Australia are a tough, fantastic short format team. You know, they're very accomplished as a team. So it was a tough day for England, I would say. But, you know, it's the first game and they've got to play better.
Things clearly do go up a notch when Australia are in town. You mentioned the debutants. So three for England. What's your take on what the side as a whole are capable of, with them included? And crucially, where do they need to improve?
I think, you know, it is a very accomplished side. You've got some young, talented cricketers. You know, Will Jacks is phenomenal. Jordan Cox has done very, very well, been really consistent. Jacob Bethel had a wonderful 100. He's still a very young man. The only thing, Jamie Overton is a fantastic all-round cricketer. He genuinely high 90s, you know, all-rounder, hits the ball many, many miles. But I was surprised because he can't bowl. And I think maybe England are missing someone like an all-rounder or another bowler or another batter just to strengthen either side of the England team. But I think all in all, look, first game, debutants, it's not always easy. You're playing against quality opposition.
Ryan Sidebottom, many thanks. And just one final story in tennis. Debutant Billy Harris and veteran Dan Evans ensured Britain's quest to reach the Davis Cup knockout stages started strongly. Harris and Evans won their singles matches, but the British team did lose the doubles. The next tie is against Argentina in Group D tomorrow.
There you go, Simon. Oh, I'm very happy to be able to say, here's Kim Cattrall.
On BBC Radio 4.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
A new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The public demonstrations have all been organized by Iranians. I can say that with hand on heart.
Starring Ed Harris and me, Kim Cattrall.
Do you just want to hear what you want to hear? Or are you asking for a professional assessment from CIA's senior female analyst of estimative probabilities?
Central Intelligence on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Just got a cable from Washington.
I'm not listening.
We can't stay here.
Starts tomorrow at 2:15.
Kim Cattrall. A quick look at the weather. Today will be cool and breezy with sunny spells and scattered showers. The showers may be heavy across the south in the afternoon with the risk of thunder locally. Showers largely ease by the evening.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. It is 23 minutes to nine and Jane Steele's just joined us in the studio to give a summary of the news.
An urgent review of the health service has warned that the NHS in England is in a critical condition. The surgeon and former Labour Minister Lord Darcy, who's now a crossbench peer, concluded the problems would take up to 8 years to fix. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting told this programme that the Prime Minister would today set out in stark terms that investment must come attached to reform. The head of the United Nations has said Israel must stop what he called dramatic violations of international humanitarian law. Antonio Guterres was speaking after the UN said six refugee agency staff were among people killed in an airstrike on a school housing displaced people in Gaza yesterday. Israel said it was targeting Hamas fighters. Data centres in the UK are to be added to a list of critical national infrastructure alongside the emergency services and financial systems, as well as energy and water supplies. They will receive extra support during a major incident such as a cyber attack. Animal rights campaigners have accused the Ministry of Defence of wasting taxpayers' money on the ceremonial bearskin caps worn by soldiers outside Buckingham Palace. The group PETA says it has obtained figures showing that the cost of each black cap, for which one bear is needed, is now £2,000. PETA is calling for fake fur to be used.
Thanks very much, Jane. 21 minutes to nine. In what has been described as one of the longest miscarriages of justice in British criminal history, Oliver Campbell, a man with severe learning difficulties who was jailed for life for the murder of a shopkeeper 3 decades ago, has had his convictions quashed by the Court of Appeal. The fight to clear his name has taken 34 years. But what does this case tell us about the way the justice system treats vulnerable people? And have lessons been learned? Glyn Maddox, KC, is Oliver Campbell's solicitor. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Thank you so much for being with us. And I should say in a moment I'll be able to talk to Mary Pryor as well, KC, chair of the Criminal Bar Association and head of the criminal team at 26 Crime. But just to stay with you, Glyn, it must still be quite a feeling today after all these years of fighting for Oliver.
I think it's a day that I never thought would happen, but I am delighted today, you know, to bask in what happened yesterday. The Court of Appeal thankfully did do the right thing, although they did it begrudgingly, I have to say. And they quashed his conviction, which I think many, many, many people who know anything about the case felt should have been quashed many, many years ago and perhaps even shouldn't have happened in the first place.
Who or what do you blame for the amount of time this has taken?
The system, basically, which is deeply dysfunctional and broken, and it takes so long, and there's no encouragement, and there's no money available to fight these sort of cases. The CCRC has looked at the case twice. It was only on the second occasion back in 2020 that we made an application, in which they then decided in Oliver's favour in 2022. to refer his case back to the Court of Appeal. I mean, it just does take a long, long time, and you've got to be persistent and you've not got to give up, which isn't easy.
We've talked, and there has been talk about, you know, the vulnerability of Oliver in all of this and what role that should have played and has played. But also, I wanted to ask you what perhaps hasn't been discussed as much is how perhaps race may have also played a factor and played a role in the conviction.
I think race was a major factor, although it wasn't hardly discussed in the Court of Appeal. I don't know what happened in 1991, when Oliver was actually convicted, or in the Court of Appeal, who looked at his case in the mid-1990s. But Dr. Alison Beck, who gave evidence for Oliver at the Court of Appeal in February, made it very clear that she thought it was a very significant factor which hadn't really come into play at all. I mean, you've got to realise that 1991, when Oliver was convicted, was before the Stephen Lawrence events, and also before Lord McPherson's report, which referred to institutional racism in the court, in the Metropolitan Police. Mm-hmm. I think that was a massive effect, but it hasn't come out. It's been what has been described as the elephant in the room.
Yes, that he as a black man was also treated differently, potentially. And I just wonder, do you think lessons have been learned?
I have no idea. I really do hope they have, but I'm not so sure. I mean,
well, let me put that to Mary Pryor, Chair of the Criminal Bar Association. Well, first of all, your view on this case and what you can say, certainly across the board.
It's a tragedy when people spend years, decades sometimes, in custody for offences where the evidence against them to a large extent has been based on a false confession. We know that 4 in 10 miscarriages of justice occur because of false confessions, and the vast majority of them are in murder or manslaughter cases.
And the treatment of vulnerable people, what can you say of that?
It's a learning curve, and vulnerabilities, as they are now described, are still new in terms of science and in terms of the legal procedure catching up with them. There are changes. There is now vulnerable witness training for all barristers, and we have advocates' toolkits which assist us with dealing with people. But the reality is that there are huge myths and stereotypes about those with learning disabilities or those with mental health problems. For example, those with mental health problems are often seen as being dangerous, whereas in reality, there's a higher risk of them being attacked. And at least 50% of them, because of the fear of the stigma of what having a diagnosis will mean, don't get any help.
It's an incredibly sobering case. Mary Pryor, thank you for that, and the hope that lessons have been learned. And I think it's just fair to reflect also what Oliver Campbell had told the BBC in his own words. He said, I could have had a full-time job, been in a relationship, had kids, been on holiday. I couldn't do that yesterday, but now I can, and I can plan the rest of my life. This was speaking yesterday. He said, I didn't put myself in prison. It's a system that put me there. And he talks about the weight being off his shoulders. But the thing is, there is still someone who committed a crime out there. And that's all I've got to say. So I'll just give the final word to Oliver Campbell there.
16 minutes to nine. The family of the jailed Belarusian opposition leader, Maria Kolesnikova, say they fear that she's being slowly killed in prison with insufficient food and extreme isolation. She's been held in solitary confinement for 18 months as extra punishment on top of an 11-year prison sentence for leading protests against Alexander Lukashenko in 2020. The news of the activist's plight came as the authoritarian leader of Belarus began a surprise release of other political prisoners, leading some to wonder whether he's signalling to Western governments that he wants to reduce his own political isolation. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
On March 10th, 2023, she was pushed in a punishment cell in total isolation.
Tatiana is desperately worried about her sister.
It's an even more horrible punishment cell.
Maria Kolesnikova was locked up for leading peaceful mass protests in Belarus in 2020. Crowds rallying against an election rigged to return Alexander Lukashenko to power. But the activist is being punished further in prison. Kept in isolation for 18 months now. No visits, no letters, no calls, and increasing concerns for her health.
What we hear, she's starving in the colony. Her illness requires a diet. She basically cannot eat what the food they provide in the colony. I believe that she already passed such a critical weight loss that endangers her life.
Tatiana compares her sister to Alexei Navalny, the Russian opposition activist who died suddenly in his Arctic prison.
International community didn't react in time for case of Navalny.
So you're asking the international community to pressure the Belarusian authorities to release Maria?
I think that any means should be used to help her, to save her, because her situation is critical.
Just walking through this pedestrian area of central Warsaw, and people in the coffee shops here, the vast majority of them are speaking Russian. A lot of them are from Belarus, people who have fled the political repression there under Alexander Lukashenko. A lot of them took part in those protests in 2020 and left so they didn't get arrested.
For Dmitry Lukša, this city is now home. The journalist spent 28 months locked up. His only crime was to report on the opposition protests and then on his country's complicity in the war on Ukraine. In one prison camp, he worked breaking rocks alongside men convicted of murder and drug smuggling. But he tells me up to 30% of the inmates were there for their politics. You can spot them by the yellow tags they have stitched on their chests. This summer, though, Dmitry was suddenly pardoned by Alexander Lukashenko. He is one of about 80 political prisoners released so far in a series of surprise amnesties.
Maybe those who started the process, the arrests, realized they went too far. I don't know, but it's such a moment of joy to be home, to hug our families and to breathe freely again. The main thing is that this process is happening, and for it not to stop.
State media are presenting the pardons as proof of a caring, humane leader. There's another election due next year, so it is possible Lukashenko's looking to soften his image. Others think he's signalling to the West that he wants to engage. The chances of big-name prisoners like Maria Kolesnikova getting out look slim. But her sister saw Russia's big prisoner swap with Western countries last month, and that gave her some hope.
What we saw, like, you can negotiate during the war or Cold War. You can negotiate with people you name terrorists, yes, or dictators, and everything is possible.
Dmitry thinks about Maria Kolesnikova a lot. She became hugely popular during the 2020 protests. But Dmitry knows how in prison, political detainees are singled out for extra punishment. And even though he's out now, he admits he jumps at every noise. Terrified, the police are coming for him again to lock him up again. You understand that you've done nothing wrong and they shouldn't be coming for you. But you can't tell your heart that, Dmitry says. It is the brutal Belarus of today. And your heart is afraid.
Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reporting there. It's 10 to 9. Today, the aid worker Simon Bowis's book is published, A Beginner's Guide to Dying. He, as predicted, is not here to see this day, but his words live on and continue to inspire as they did in the final months of his life after his articles about how to live in his local newspaper, the Jersey Evening Post, went viral. But his wife, Auralee Bowis, is here, and she spoke to me on yesterday's programme about what life has been like since losing Simon in the summer and how it has been sharing her husband with so many people around the world. Many of you have been in touch off the back of our conversation yesterday and also when I first interviewed Simon in July in what ended up being his final broadcast interview because 11 days later he died. Yesterday, this was how Auralee described watching her husband go towards death.
I often felt lonely even before his death, in the sense that he was pulling away a bit. Mm. I think he might have done it naturally, but with an effort to actually gently free me, you know, away from him. And as sad as it is, as I feel like very grateful in the way that we managed to discuss everything for months, but also have normal days.
Auralee Bowis there. And listening to that again is one of our listeners, Denise, who did get in touch after hearing that conversation yesterday. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
I understand you yourself were receiving treatment, chemotherapy, yesterday.
Yes, I had my second treatment. I first heard Simon's interview in July when I was actually not needing treatment but knew it was on its way after over a year. Right. And to hear his voice again the day I was going in for treatment seemed really powerful and really helpful.
Oh, well, I'm happy to hear that. And I hope it went as okay as possible.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. If I can say it or put it like that. Because I think I know from your messages, having had a look of you getting in touch, and this is why it's always brilliant to be able to hear from you, our listeners, is what spoke to you was about how he talked about the guilt he felt towards his family. And then hearing Auralee yesterday picked up on how it was for her on this side of things.
Yes, I think I felt when I got my diagnosis, because I didn't need any treatment, I had a year to get ready for it. And it just gave me, you know, Simon's enjoying the smallest things, enjoying the sunshine, enjoying walking the dog. All those things suddenly became so much more powerful and so much more important. And I tried to share that with family and friends. Mm. And I think I also know I'm just, it's not that I'm just putting on a brave face, but I feel that they can't see, they're looking into my future and the journey and the thought of being without me. Mm. And I'm feeling in the now. And, you know, things are good. I am really lucky. Treatment is not as bad as what first intended. I mean, initially it was going to be a lot sooner and I thought I had a much shorter lifespan. At the moment it looks, you know, a lot more hopeful. And it's trying to, it's handling that guilt that explain to your family, they turn up for a coffee or something and you have to give them this worst message and land it with them, and you can't do anything to actually say, you know, actually it's not so bad, let's enjoy the now, because now is what we've got and it's really special.
Was there anything that you learned from what Auralee had to say as well?
Yes, it was interesting hearing that Simon chose to withdraw a bit, and that he, you know, he made the most of everything right to the end. And I also kind of thought how important that brilliant palliative care was, because that makes such a difference. That kind of gives me something to, you know, I know this journey isn't going to be great and palliative care is something we'll talk about, but I know the hospices are so amazing and the palliative care nurses are so amazing. And just hearing Simon's story of that, I remember him talking about muscadet and morphine. And at the moment, I'm completely off alcohol, but I kind of thought, oh, well, you know, there's brighter side.
There's something there.
Yeah.
Potentially. Well, I wish you all the best for it. I know this, your cancer, not to go into too much of your personal information, had been there and then came up again, and this is why now you've got to have the treatment. But how fascinating to hear what spoke to you, and also how it was to help potentially with some of those conversations with your family. Denise, we wish you all the best here at the Today programme, and thank you for being in touch.
Thank you very much.
5 minutes to nine. One of the big winners at the National Television Awards last night was ITV's Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. It chronicled, of course, the heroic struggle for justice by postmasters against the Post Office after the Horizon IT scandal. Mr. Bates versus the Post Office was voted Best New Drama. Toby Jones won Best Drama Performance for playing the title role, Mr. Bates. The programme also received a special impact award, with one of the real Post Office scandal victims using the acceptance speech to criticise the support offered by the new government. Joe Hamilton went on stage and said, "What I'd like you to know is I went to Westminster a couple of weeks back and saw the new minister. And trust me, nothing has changed." Well, Gwyneth Hughes is the screenwriter behind, Golden Globe nominated screenwriter behind ITV's Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, and joins us now. Gwyneth, good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations. How are you feeling this morning?
A little bit fragile. Very proud, very excited, yeah. And surprised. I mean, the whole thing's been a roller coaster of surprises from beginning to end, really.
Well, at this stage, it's not a surprise to win the award, is it? Maybe how it kicked off across the countries we'll get into was a surprise. But last night, you went in as firm favourites, didn't you?
Well, it was a very strong field. I mean, because we won the first two, by the time it got to the third one, we were sat in a row with faces like gloom, going, "Oh, we can't possibly win this one." So winning Best Drama at the end, really, I mean, it was fantastic, a really exciting night.
To
be surrounded by all those beaming faces, you know, the postmasters all around, loads of them came and they were just so thrilled.
Well, exactly.
And,
You are a screenwriter. Your business is emotional narratives that grip people, that tell an important story. What was it about this emotional narrative? What was it about this story that had such appeal?
To me in the beginning, do you mean, or to the audience?
No, to the audience. Well, yeah, actually, no, both. Oh, yeah. What was the appeal to you first, and then we'll get to the reason it cut through across the country?
Well, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, to begin with, I just thought this is completely unbelievable. This could possibly happen in Britain. And, sorry, the cleaner's just walking through.
You sound like you've got postmasters currently sort of, who've maybe stayed over at your house and feeling a bit fragile this morning too.
Yeah. I think it's a bit like that, yeah. Eggs and bacon this morning. So I think it's just, you know, it's a story about how powerful people deal with powerless people, and particularly what happens when the powerful underestimate the enemy. And, you know, they spent 20 years looking at Alan Bates and seeing this mild-mannered, quietly spoken, you know, ordinary little English guy. And they underestimated him. You know, they never noticed in all that time that the guy's made of pure steel. And that really interested me. You know, how the little guys can win in the end is obviously fantastic. And old Hollywood story, really.
Sorry to interrupt. And in the end, was it almost accidentally such a political campaign? I mean, it was a remarkable story first, and then the politics came second.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's extremely political with a small p. You know, anything that's to do with power is political, but with the smallest possible p. Because I don't think, I mean, I think one of the reasons it got such a large audience is because, you know, often with campaigning pieces like this, the production seems to expect you to believe in everything that it believes. And I think that we didn't do that. We tried really hard. Looking back, I can see that we tried really hard to say to the entire audience, the entire country, you can come to this wherever your politics are. Doesn't matter what you vote. Doesn't matter what any of the sub-postmasters vote. This is an abuse of power, and we should all be interested in it. And I think people ran with that. Looking back, I think why the audience was so large.
A final, very, very brief thought. What do you make of the fact that, as Joe Hamilton says, nothing's changed?
Oh, well, they're very impatient. Obviously, they've had enough after 20-odd years.
Yeah.
They're, of course, they're still